We're talking with Barack Obama, author of Dreams from My Father, A Story of Race and Inheritance, published by Times Books. Barack, before the break, I mentioned friends of your generation,
right,
who Wall Street, and we should tell our friends in the audience that you did take time away from Chicago to go to Harvard Law School, where you became president of Harvard Law Review.
That's right.
I hate saying first black, but it's in the book, and whatever, you were a leader who was elected.
Right.
You didn't go into Wall Street. You've gone back to Chicago,
right,
and civic rights, civil
right,
rights.
Right. You know, I'm currently a practicing civil rights lawyer, which means that I get involved in a whole range of different issues that touch on issues of race. You know, I do voting rights. I do employment discrimination law.
Well, NAACP Legal Defense Fund had really been one of the pioneers in that field.
Right. Well, in fact, and we do some work with the LDF, certainly on voting rights as well as some of our employment discrimination work. Well, you know, one thing that's interesting about the current debate surrounding affirmative action is how little attention is paid to the difficulties in prosecuting employment discrimination. If you listen to the debate, you would think that you walk into any major corporation, there are all these black folks there doing great, and all these Latino folks are doing great, and Asian Americans are running everything. And the truth of the matter is,
some of them are women.
Right.
And
the truth is, if you walk into these offices, that's not the case, and it's extraordinarily hard to bring employment discrimination suits, just because generally public interest firms are outmanned, outgunned in terms of the money and lawyers that can be devoted to these cases, and the judiciary these days is not very sympathetic to the cause of civil rights. And so as a consequence, part of the reason I think that I wrote the book and included those chapters you mentioned on community organizing is that progress is probably not going to come through the courts these days. We're not going to see a Brown versus Board of Education type of decision anytime soon. What we're going to have to do is to sort of work at the grassroots level and the community level, and also rediscover some sense of mutual responsibility between black and white America if we're going to make progress into the 21st century.
Isn't that wishful thinking? Because until economics are... liberalism seems to fly out the window when people are nervous about their economy.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that is true. What I do think, though, is that there is the possibility of building common ground around an economic agenda that would be good for all people. And, you know, the problem we have... and this is why the race card can always be played, is that basically we live where blacks and whites are strangers to each other. We don't know each other's stories. We don't have a sense that we have so much in common. And you know, I tell an interesting story. Actually, it's not in the book, but when I got married, I invited Tutu, my grandmother, this little white lady, out to the south side of Chicago to my mother-in-law's house. And so my grandmother walks in, it's all black people in the room, and she's, you know, the only white person there except for my mother, and she's feeling a little nervous and a little out of place, and she suddenly sees this table set with fried chicken and succotash and you know, a jello mold and all the things, and suddenly she realizes that, you know, she has a culture that she's sharing with all these people, just as her grandson is now going to be sharing a family with these folks. And there's a sense of recognition there. And I think that we can build a progressive politics.
Oh, there's a lovely scene at the wedding where she puts her arms around two of the children and says, well, these are my two new sons or daughters
there. Right. And that's exactly right. And so... you know, when I see the progress that's made in my family in terms of understanding, in terms of a spirit of communion, then I think that the country can achieve that too. But I think you're right that at times of economic scarcity, generally the politicians in this country right now want to look for scapegoats, want to organize around race as opposed to around principle and around values. And I think that's a mistake. And I think that can be countered, but it's going to require the kinds of grassroots mobilization and the kinds of work at a local level that I think I talk about a lot in those chapters on Chicago.
Wonderful man there, Reverend Wright.
Right, and yeah. who is my pastor, and he is a wonderful man. And I think that's an example of, he's a pastor of a large congregation in Chicago. And one of the interesting things that I discover in my journey to discover mm-hmm. what my identity is and who my father is also discovering sort of my own faith, which is not necessarily a traditional faith. I don't come out of an institutionalized religious setting, but what becomes important to me as I work with churches in the mm-hmm. south side of Chicago and low-income neighborhoods is to realize that, you know, all the stories and songs of the church, you know, the hope that is embodied in yeah. the church, the sense of liberation that is embodied in the historically African American church, is really something that moves me deeply, and I think is probably the main pillar around which a lot of inner cities communities are going to be built. And Reverend Wright, my pastor, who I speak about in a chapter in the book, I think represents the best of what the black church has to offer.
Barack, I can't escape without asking about the trip to Kenya.
Right.
And meeting all of the relatives, all your half-brothers and sisters, right. and especially the wonderful sister,
Alma, right.
who comes to visit you from having been studying in Germany,
right.
and really is like you're taking you into the dark of explaining your father to you.
Well, that's right. She's a wonderful sister and a wonderful character, I hope, in the book. I hope she comes across that way. She and I first make contact when she finally visits me in Chicago, and she basically tells me the real story of what happened to my father after he left us, and sort of punctures some of the myths
yeah.
that I've been carrying around about him. And I realized that he had a tough time and that he went through the same struggles as I did. And I think it was that meeting with her that then opens the door and allows me to return to Kenya and finally fully embrace that side of my family and to understand what
even your older
that country's
brother.
About. My older brother, Roy,
yeah.
who we now call Abongo. He's reasserted his heritage. But both of them teach me about family and teach me what it means to be a part of the African family.
And even the African family, and we talk about America and economics,
right.
they were too, the sort of the problems over your father's inheritance.
Right.
It is interesting how when the dollar comes in, mm-hmm. love can sometimes fly out.
Well, I think that's right. And one of the things that I learned by going back to Kenya and learning the story of my father and grandfather is that you know, we can't look at Africa through rose-tinted glasses. I mean, I think that the there's good and bad in Africa. There's good and bad in black folks.
Yeah.
Just like there's good and bad in white folks. And what that does then is it gives us a responsibility. We have to choose what inheritance we want. Is it an inheritance of money or is it an inheritance of values? And I guess I end up opting for the latter.
And I look forward to speaking with you many more times, Barack.
I had a wonderful time.
This is only the beginning.
Context of white supremacy. Justice Gusty Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, November 9th, 2012, so I have been told. We will be back tomorrow. That would be Saturday evening, the compensatory call-in. Looking forward to hearing field notes. All of the victims of racism, black people who have been out and about, whether you've been on the job or if you've just been going to the gym or wherever you normally go, to the bank, whatever you're normally activities are on the plantation. I'm very interested in hearing what people have been experiencing, if you've been hearing white coworkers on the job saying things, or if you're around white people in other situations, if they've been commenting on the election, how they feel about it. Very much looking forward to that. And anything else, if you have been making other observations, if you've been reading, I would definitely encourage folks to be checking out, reading the newspaper, looking for reports, being observant, trying to pay attention to things that are happening locally, nationally, globally. It's been a lot going on this week with the election and since. Tune in tomorrow, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Dial in, share. Looking forward to a great broadcast. You heard at the beginning the audio clip, Connie Martinson, racist suspect. She did a 1995 interview with President Obama about his autobiography, Dreams from My Father. That entire interview, you can view it. It's on YouTube, the full, I think it's like 20, 25 minutes, 26 minutes. You can check it out. Really interesting clip, I think, particularly now that it is almost 20 years old, that interview. Anywho, this would be installment number 3, the Dreams from My Father study session. Again, the audiobook is abridged. If you have the paperback, if you have the text, an unedited version might be a good idea to have that handy while we are listening to the audio segments. There's just tons of segments that have been removed from the audiobook. I think they took out all of the portions of the book that talk about Frank Marshall Davis. I think they took out some other pertinent portions that, in my view, reveal truth about white supremacy, racism. They took out some of the segments around the episode where President Obama's white grandmother, where she had the incident where a black male asked her for money while she was at the bus stop, and her white husband, President Obama's white grandfather, thought that she was being racist and that she was just making a big deal about this because it was a black male, and they took out some of the information around that. So really kind of got to be on your P's and Q's if you have the book. It should be easily accessible. You should be able to get a copy for free, really. Know they got it at your library. I wouldn't care where you happen to be, even the area that has the greatest concentration of racist white supremacists. I'm pretty sure they would have a copy of this book, if nothing more than to point out what a rabid socialist, communist, Muslim, racist they think President Barack Obama is. So I would encourage getting your hands on a copy and just checking it out. Not that I'm supporting President Obama, not that I'm saying to read it. He's such a great guy and has so many wonderful things to say. I just think it is fascinating to have the President of the United States having written some of the things that are in this book, particularly on racism. It's pretty much every page is dealing with some aspect of racism, white supremacy. So I'm going to have the book with me as we listen. Once we get done with the first segment, if there are any portions that have been edited out that I think, you know, we should keep in mind, I'll include those once we get done with the audio segment. If anyone is listening in, if you have the audio, if you have the book, and you think there are any segments that were left out that we should, you know, think about, keep in mind, definitely share. I know for me last week, there were so many chunks that were not in the audiobook. It kind of it took away from my enjoyment of listening to the audiobook because I was seeing just massive segments of text that were not in the audiobook that I thought were extremely important. So major heads up on that. Definitely want to get a chance to copy. Get your hands on a copy of the book if you are following along with us. I also want to encourage listeners to be thinking. I think we still have got about 3, maybe even 4 weeks left I guess by the end of the day, we'd probably be at about the halfway point, maybe a little bit short. Kind of be thinking if there are books that you would like to study. We definitely can continue with the audiobooks. I think that's something people have expressed that they like. I know a lot of people, they don't have time. Many people have said that they just don't have time to read. They're kept so busy on the plantation with their work schedule, and they have offspring taking care of them. So I know that can be a challenge. I'm down to continue picking out some audiobooks, although I do want to read 2,000 Seasons. I'm not sure if that exists in audio book format, but man, I think that is a phenomenal book. And I've said again, that was one of the most helpful books that I ever read in terms of breaking a lot of the Christian religious racist programming that I had been brain trashed with. So that we definitely will be doing that at some point, long as we're able to, white people permitting, we continue broadcasting. But yeah, be thinking if there's some books. I know Henrietta Lacks, the black female, where they took her genetic material and used it to do experiments and all of that. There's an audiobook detailing what happened to her. We could do that. The Help audiobook on a bridge, too. We could do that. Wide open field. So kind of be thinking if you have suggestions. Think about it. I know Colin Powell's autobiography is in audiobook format. I was thinking that might be interesting. I was even thinking Condoleezza Rice. She has her own autobiography. So just be thinking if there are texts that you think we should check out that would be of interest and reveal truth about racism, white supremacy. Let us know. Have some suggestions. Maybe 3-4 weeks down the road, that can be the next book that we go to. I will give out the number in case you want to listen in on your phone. We should be back at the Black Talk Radio Network broadcasting. So if you want to listen online, we should be available there. If you want to listen via phone, the number to dial is 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you want to participate. The way these work, if folks are new, we do the audio plays for about 30 minutes, 35 minutes. That'll end, and then I'll go to the phone lines, and very much looking forward to hearing participation. This is not just Gus talking off and rambling about what he thought about the book. This is supposed to be an exchange of views, different things that stand out. What does this book communicate? What messages are being communicated to white people? What messages are being communicated to victims? I think one of our listeners said from the very first program, the same text, the same message can please white people, racist man, racist woman, racist child, simultaneously confuse non-white people, victims of racism. And I think we've seen a lot of illustrations of that in the first portion of the book. With that, we will get started. Again, the audio segment is about 30, 35 minutes or so. Kick back, take notes. I'm pleading if you're listening in, if you have the book, if you have the ability, I would highly encourage just have it in front and be flipping through. That's what I'm going to be doing. Be flipping through as we listen. I can guarantee you there are going to be huge chunks missing. I think this is his college years. And as I wrote in the description, I think, you know, we should be getting to when he begins talking about some of his experiences with tragic arrangements. Hopefully they did not remove that from the audiobook, because when I read the book, I thought that also revealed quite a bit about racism, white supremacy. So without further ado, we will get to it. President Barack Obama's autobiography, Dreams from My Father. This would be disc number 3.
When I heard about a transfer program that Occidental had arranged with Columbia University, I'd been quick to apply. I figured that if there weren't any more black students at Columbia than there were at Oxy, I'd be at least in the heart of a true city with black neighborhoods in close proximity. As it was, there wasn't much in L.A. to hold me back. Most of my friends were graduating that year. With the Wall Street boom, Manhattan was humming, new developments cropping up everywhere, men and women barely out of their 20s already enjoying ridiculous wealth, the fashion merchants fast on their heels. The beauty, the filth, the noise, and the excess, all of it dazzled my senses. There seemed no constraints on the originality of lifestyles or the manufacture of desire. A more expensive restaurant, a finer suit of clothes, a more exclusive night spot, a more beautiful woman, a more potent high. Uncertain of my ability to steer a course of moderation, fearful of falling into old habits, I took on the temperament, if not the convictions, of a street-corner preacher, prepared to see temptation everywhere, ready to overrun a fragile will. My reaction was more than just an attempt to curb an excessive appetite, though, or a response to sensory overload. Beneath the hum, the motion, I was seeing the steady fracturing of the world taking place. I had seen worse poverty in Indonesia, and glimpsed the violent mood of inner-city kids in L.A. I had grown accustomed everywhere to suspicion between the races. But whether because of New York's density or because of its scale, it was only now that I began to grasp the almost mathematical precision with which America's race and class problems joined, the depth, the ferocity of resulting tribal wars, the bile that flowed freely not just out on the streets but in the stalls of Columbia's bathrooms as well, where no matter how many times the administration tried to paint over them, the walls remained scratched with blunt correspondence between niggers and kikes. It was as if all middle ground had collapsed, utterly. And nowhere, it seemed, was that collapse more apparent than in the black community I had so lovingly imagined and within which I had hoped to find refuge. I might meet a black friend at his Midtown law firm, and before heading to lunch at the MoMA, I would look out across the city toward the East River from his high-rise office, imagining a satisfactory life for myself, a vocation, a family, a home, until I noticed that the only other blacks in the office were messengers or clerks. The only other blacks in the museum, the blue-jacketed security guards who counted the hours before they could catch their trains home to Brooklyn or Queens. I might wander through Harlem to play on courts I'd once read about, or to hear Jesse Jackson make a speech on 125th. Or, on a rare Sunday morning, to sit in the back pews of Abyssinian Baptist Church, lifted by the gospel choir's sweet, sorrowful song, and catch a fleeting glimpse of that thing which I sought. But I had no guide that might show me how to join this troubled world. And when I looked for an apartment there, I found Sugar Hill's elegant brownstones occupied and out of reach, the few decent rental buildings with 10-year-long waiting lists, so that all that remained were the rows and rows of uninhabitable tenements, in front of which young men counted out their rolls of large bills, and winos slouched and stumbled and wept softly to themselves. I took all this as a personal affront, a mockery of my tender ambitions, although when I brought up the subject with people who had lived in New York for a while, I was told there was nothing original about my observations. The city was out of control, they said, the polarization a natural phenomenon, like monsoons or continental drift. Political discussions, the kind that at Occidental had once seemed so intense and purposeful, came to take on the flavor of the socialist conferences I sometimes attended at Cooper Union, or the African cultural fairs that took place in Harlem and Brooklyn during the summers, a few of the many diversions New York had to offer, like going to a foreign film or ice skating at Rockefeller Center. With a bit of money, I was free to live like most middle-class blacks in Manhattan, free to choose a motif around which to organize my life, free to patch together a collage of styles, friends, watering holes, political affiliations. I sensed, though, that at some stage, maybe when you had children and decided you could stay in the city only at the cost of a private school, or when you began taking cabs at night to avoid the subways, or when you decided that you needed a doorman in your apartment building, your choice was irrevocable, the divide was now impassable, and you would find yourself on the side of the line that you'd never intended to be on. Unwilling to make that choice, I spent a year walking from one end of Manhattan to the other. Like a tourist, I watched the range of human possibility on display, trying to trace out my future in the lives of the people I saw, looking for some opening through which I could re-enter. It was in this humorless mood that my mother and sister found me when they came to visit during my first summer in New York. "He's so skinny," Maya said to my mother. "He only has 2 towels, my mother shouted as she inspected the bathroom. "And 3 plates! They both began to giggle. That summer I had found a job clearing a construction site on the Upper West Side, so my mother and sister spent most of their days exploring the city on their own. When we met for dinner, they would give me a detailed report of their adventures, eating strawberries and cream at the plaza, taking the ferry to the Statue of Liberty, visiting the Cezanne's at the Met. I would eat in silence until they were finished and then begin a long discourse on the problems of the city and the politics of the dispossessed. I scolded Maya for spending one evening watching TV instead of reading the novels I had bought for her.
I instructed my mother on the various ways that foreign donors and international development organizations like the one she was working for bred dependence in the Third World. When the two of them withdrew to the kitchen, I would overhear Maya complaining to my mother. Barry's okay, isn't he? I mean, I hope he doesn't lose his cool and become one of those freaks you see on the street around here. One evening, I was thumbing through the Village Voice, and my mother's eyes lit on an advertisement for a movie, Black Orpheus, that was showing downtown. She insisted that we go see it that night. She said that it was the first foreign film she had ever seen. I was only 16 then, she told us as we entered the elevator. I'd just been accepted to the University of Chicago. Gramps hadn't told me yet that he wouldn't let me go, and I was there for the summer, working as an au pair. It was the first time I'd ever really been on my own. Gosh, I felt like such an adult. And when I saw this film, I thought it was the most beautiful thing I had ever seen. We took a cab to the Revival Theater where the movie was playing. The film, a groundbreaker of sorts due to its mostly black Brazilian cast, had been made in the 50s. The storyline was simple. The myth of the ill-fated lovers Orpheus and Eurydice, set in the favelas of Rio during Carnival. In technicolor splendor, set against scenic green hills, the black and brown Brazilians sang and danced and strummed guitars, like carefree birds in colorful plumage. About halfway through the movie, I decided I'd seen enough and turned to my mother to see if she might be ready to go. But her face, lit by the blue glow of the screen, was set in a wistful gaze. At that moment, I felt as if I were being given a window into her heart, the unreflective heart of her youth. I suddenly realized that the depiction of childlike blacks I was now seeing on the screen, the reverse image of Conrad's Dark Savages, was what my mother had carried with her to Hawaii all those years before, a reflection of the simple fantasies that had been forbidden to a white middle-class girl from Kansas, the promise of another life, warm, sensual, exotic, different. I turned away, embarrassed for her, irritated with the people around me. Sitting there in the dark, I was reminded of a conversation I'd had a few years earlier with a friend of my mother's, an Englishman who had worked for an international aid organization throughout Africa and Asia. He had told me that of all the different peoples he had met in his travels, the Dik of Sudan were the strangest. "Usually, after a month or two, you make contact," he had said. "Even where you don't speak the language, there's a smile or a joke, you know, some semblance of recognition. But at the end of a year with the Dik, they remained utterly alien to me. They laughed at the things that drove me to despair. What I thought was funny seemed to leave them stone cold." I'd spared him the information that the Dik were Nilots, distant cousins of mine. I'd tried to imagine this pale Englishman on a parched desert somewhere, his back turned away from a circle of naked tribesmen, his eyes searching an empty sky, bitter in his solitude. And the same thought had occurred to me then that I carried with me now as I left the movie theater with my mother and sister. The emotions between the races could never be pure. Even love was tarnished by the desire to find in the other some element that was missing in ourselves. Whether we sought out our demons or our salvation, the other race would always remain just that, menacing, alien, and apart. "Kind of corny, huh?" Maya said as my mother went to the bathroom. "What?" "The movie. It was kind of corny. Just Mom's style." For the next several days, I tried to avoid situations where my mother and I might be forced to talk. Then, a few days before they were about to leave, my mother noticed a letter addressed to my father in my hand. I asked her if she had an international postage stamp. "You guys arranging for a visit?" she asked. I told her briefly of plans to visit Kenya. "Well, I think it would be wonderful for you two to finally get to know each other," she said. "It was probably a bit tough for a 10-year-old to take, but now that you're older..." I shrugged. "Who knows," I said. "I hope you don't feel resentful towards him." "Why would I?" "I don't know." We sat there for a while, and then, without any prompting, my mother began to retell an old story, in a distant voice, as if she were telling it to herself. "It wasn't your father's fault that he left, you know. I divorced him. When the two of us got married, your grandparents weren't happy with the idea, but they said okay. They probably couldn't have stopped us anyway. And they eventually came around to the idea that it was the right thing to do. Then Barack's father, your grandfather, Hussein, wrote Gramps this long, nasty letter saying he didn't approve of the marriage. He didn't want the Obama blood sullied by a white woman, he said. Well, you can imagine how Gramps reacted to that. And then there was a problem with your father's first wife. He had told me they were separated, but it was a village wedding, so there were no legal documents that could show a divorce. My mother's chin began to tremble, and she bit down on her lip, steadying herself. She said, "Your father wrote back saying he was going to go ahead with it. Then you were born, and we agreed that the three of us would return to Kenya after he finished his studies. But your grandfather Hussein was still writing to your father, threatening to have his student visa revoked." By this time, Toot had become hysterical. She had read about the Mau Mau Rebellion in Kenya a few years earlier, which the Western press really played up, and she was sure that I would have my head chopped off and you would be taken away. Even then, it might have worked out. When your father graduated from University of Hawaii, he received two scholarship offers. One was to the New School here in New York. The other one was to Harvard. The New School agreed to pay for everything, room and board, a job on campus, enough to support all three of us. Harvard just agreed to pay tuition. But Barack was such a stubborn bastard, he had to go to Harvard. "How can I refuse the best education?" he told me. That's all he could think about, proving he was the best. My mother sighed, running her hands through her hair. Later, when he came to visit us in Hawaii that time, he wanted us to come live with him. But I was still married to Lolo then, and his third wife had just left him, and I just didn't think. She stopped and laughed to herself. "Did I ever tell you that he was late for our first date? He asked me to meet him in front of the university library at 1. When I got there, he hadn't arrived, but I figured I'd give him a few minutes. It was a nice day, so I laid out on one of the benches, and before I knew it, I had fallen asleep. Well, an hour later, he shows up with a couple of his friends. I woke up, and the three of them were standing over me, and I heard your father saying, serious as he can be, 'You see, gentlemen, I told you that she was a fine girl, and that she would wait for me.'" My mother laughed once more, and once again I saw her as the child she had been. In her smiling, slightly puzzled face, I saw what all children must see at some point if they are to grow up. Their parents' lives revealed to them as separate and apart, reaching out beyond the point of their union, or the birth of a child, lives unfurling back to grandparents, great-grandparents, an infinite number of chance meetings, misunderstandings, projected hopes, limited circumstances. My mother was that girl, with the movie of beautiful black people in her head, flattered by my father's attention, confused and alone, trying to break out of the grip of her own parents' lives. The innocence she carried that day, waiting for my father, had been tinged with misconceptions, her own needs. But it was a guileless need, one without self-consciousness. And perhaps that's how any love begins. Impulses and cloudy images that allow us to break across our solitude, and then, if we're lucky, are finally transformed into something firmer. What I heard from my mother that day, speaking about my father, was something that I suspect most Americans will never hear from the lips of those of another race, and so cannot be expected to believe might exist between black and white. The love of someone who knows your life in the round, a love that will survive disappointment. She saw my father as everyone hopes at least one other person might see him. She had tried to help the child who never knew him see him in the same way. And it was the look on her face that day that I would remember when a few months later I called to tell her that my father had died and heard her cry out over the distance. In 1983, I decided to become a community organizer. There wasn't much detail to the idea. I didn't know anyone making a living that way. When classmates in college asked me just what it was that a community organizer did, I couldn't answer them directly. Instead, I'd pronounce on the need for change. Change won't come from the top, I would say. Change will come from a mobilized grassroots. That's what I'll do. I'll organize black folks at the grassroots for change. And my friends, black and white, would heartily commend me for my ideals before heading toward the post office to mail in their graduate school applications. I couldn't really blame them for being skeptical. Now, with the benefit of hindsight, I can construct a certain logic to my decision. Show how becoming an organizer was part of that larger narrative, starting with my father and his father before him, my mother and her parents, my memories of Indonesia, with its beggars and farmers and the loss of Lolo to power, on through Ray and Regina, and my move to New York, my father's death. I can see that my choices were never truly mine alone, and that that is how it should be, that to assert otherwise is to chase after a sorry sort of freedom. But such recognition only came later. At the time, about to graduate from college, I was operating mainly on impulse, like a salmon swimming blindly upstream toward the site of his own conception. In classes and seminars, I would dress up these impulses in the slogans and theories that I'd discovered in books, thinking, falsely, that the slogans meant something, that they somehow made what I felt more amenable to proof. But at night, lying in bed, I would let the slogans drift away, to be replaced with a series of images, romantic images, of a past I had never known. They were of the civil rights movement, mostly, the grainy black-and-white footage that appears every February during Black History Month, the same images that my mother had offered me as a child. A pair of college students, hair short, back straight, placing their orders at a lunch counter teetering on the edge of riot. SNCC workers standing on a porch in some Mississippi backwater, trying to convince a family of sharecroppers to register to vote. A county jail bursting with children, their hands clasped together, singing freedom songs. Such images became a form of prayer for me, bolstering my spirits, channeling my emotions in a way that words never could. They told me, although even this much understanding may have come later, is also a construct, containing its own falsehoods, that I wasn't alone in my particular struggles, and that communities had never been a given in this country, at least not for blacks. Communities had to be created, fought for, tended like gardens. They expanded or contracted with the dreams of men, and in the civil rights movement, those dreams had been large. In the sit-ins, the marches, the jailhouse songs, I saw the African-American community becoming more than just the place where you had been born or the house where you'd been raised. Through organizing, through shared sacrifice, membership had been earned. And because membership was earned, because this community I imagined was still in the making, built on the promise that the larger American community, black, white, and brown, could somehow redefine itself, I believed that it might, over time, admit the uniqueness of my own life. That was my idea of organizing. It was a promise of redemption. And so, in the months leading up to graduation, I wrote to every civil rights organization I could think of, to any black elected official in the country with a progressive agenda, to neighborhood councils and tenant rights groups. When no one wrote back, I wasn't discouraged. I decided to find more conventional work for a year, to pay off my student loans, and maybe even save a little bit. Eventually, a consulting house to a multinational corporation agreed to hire me as a research assistant. Like a spy behind enemy lines, I arrived every day at my mid-Manhattan office and sat at my computer terminal, checking the Reuters machine that blinked bright emerald messages from across the globe. As far as I could tell, I was the only black man in the company, a source of shame for me, but a source of considerable pride for the company's secretarial pool. One day, as I sat down at my computer to write an article on interest rates, something unexpected happened. Alma called. I had never met this half-sister. We had written only intermittently. I knew that she had left Kenya to study in Germany, and in our letters we had mentioned the possibility of my going there for a visit, or perhaps her coming to the States. But the plans had always been left vague. Neither of us had any money, we would say. Maybe next year. Our correspondence maintained a cordial distance. Now, suddenly, I heard her voice for the first time. It was soft and dark, tinged with a colonial accent. For a few moments I couldn't understand the words, only the sound, a sound that seemed to have always been there, misplaced but not forgotten. She was coming to the States, she said, on a trip with several friends. Could she come to see me in New York? Of course, I said. You can stay with me. I can't wait. And she laughed, and I laughed, and then the line grew quiet with static and the sound of her breath. Well, she said, I can't stay on the phone too long. It's so expensive. Here's the flight information. And we hung up quickly after that, as if our contact was a treat to be doled out in small measures. 2 days before she was scheduled to arrive, Alma called again, the voice thicker now, barely a whisper. "I can't come after all," she said. "One of our brothers, David, he's been killed in a motorcycle accident. I don't know any more than that." She began to cry. "Oh, Barak, why do these things happen to us?" I tried to comfort her as best I could. I asked her if I could do anything for her. I told her there would be other times for us to see each other. Eventually, her voice quieted. She had to go book a flight home to Kenya, she said. "Okay then, Barak. See you. Bye." After she hung up, I left my office telling my secretary I'd be gone for the day. For hours I wandered the streets of Manhattan, the sound of Alma's voice playing over and over in my mind. A continent away, a woman cries. On a dark, dusty road, a boy skids out of control, tumbling against hard earth, wheels spinning to silence. Who were these people, I asked myself, these strangers who carried my blood? What might save this woman from her sorrow? What wild, unspoken dreams had this boy possessed? Who was I, who shed no tears at the loss of his own? I still wonder sometimes how that first contact with Alma altered my life. Maybe by this time I was already committed to organizing, and Alma's voice simply served to remind me that I still had wounds to heal and could not heal myself. Or maybe, if our brother David hadn't died when he did, and Alma had come to New York as originally planned, and I had learned from her then what I would only learn later, about Kenya and about our father, maybe it would have relieved certain pressures that had built up inside me, showing me a different idea of community, allowing my ambitions to travel a narrower, more personal course, so that in the end I might have given myself over to stocks and bonds and the pull of respectability. I don't know. What is certain is that a few months after Alma's call, I turned in my resignation at the consulting firm and began looking in earnest for an organizing job. Once again, most of my letters went unanswered, and after 6 months I was broke, unemployed, eating soup from a can. I had all but given up on organizing when I received a call from a guy named Marty Kaufman. He explained that he'd started an organizing project in Chicago and was looking to hire a trainee. When he came to meet me in New York, his appearance didn't inspire much confidence. He was a white man of medium height, wearing a rumpled suit over a pudgy frame. His face was heavy with two-day-old whiskers. Behind a pair of thick, wire-rimmed glasses, his eyes seemed set in a perpetual squint. But he was smart and committed to his work. Marty had started organizing in the 60s with the student protests and ended up staying with it for 15 years. Farmers in Nebraska, blacks in Philadelphia, Mexicans in Chicago. Now he was trying to pull urban blacks and suburban whites together around a plan to save manufacturing jobs in metropolitan Chicago. He needed somebody to work with him, he said. Somebody black. "Most of our work is with churches," he said. "If poor and working-class people want to build real power, they have to have some sort of institutional base. With the unions in the shape they're in, the churches are the only game in town. That's where the people are, and that's where the values are, even if they've been buried under a lot of bullshit. Churches won't work with you, though, just out of the goodness of their hearts. They'll talk a good game, a sermon on Sunday maybe, or a special offering for the homeless. But if push comes to shove, they won't really move unless you can show them how it'll help them pay their heating bill." Marty poured himself more hot water. "What do you know about Chicago, anyway?" I thought for a moment. "Hog butcher to the world?" I said finally. Marty shook his head. "The butchery's closed a while ago." "The Cubs never win," I offered. "True." "America's most segregated city," I said. "A black man, Harold Washington, was just elected mayor, and white people don't like it." "So you've been following Harold's career," Marty said. "I'm surprised you haven't gone to work for him." "I tried," I said. "His office didn't write back." Marty smiled and took off his glasses, cleaning them with the end of his tie. "Well, that's the thing to do, isn't it?" he said. "If you're young and black and interested in social issues, find a political campaign to work for. A powerful patron. Somebody who can help you with your own career. And Harold's powerful, no doubt about it. Lots of charisma. He has almost monolithic support in the black community. About half the Hispanics, a handful of white liberals. You're right about one thing, though. The whole atmosphere in the city is polarized. A big media circus. Not much is getting done." "And whose fault is that?" I said. Marty put his glasses back on and met my stare. "It's not a question of fault," Marty said. "It's a question of whether any politician, Even somebody with Harold's talent can do much to break the cycle. A polarized city isn't necessarily a bad thing for a politician, black or white. Marty offered to start me off at $10,000 the first year, with a $2,000 travel allowance to buy a car. The salary would go up if things worked out. A week later, I loaded up my car and drove to Chicago. I arrived in Chicago in July, and the sun sparkled through the deep green trees. The boats were out of their moorings, their distant sails like the wings of doves across Lake Michigan. Marty had told me that he would be busy those first few days, and so I was left on my own. I had bought a map, and I followed Martin Luther King Drive from its northernmost to its southernmost point, then went back up Cottage Grove, down byways and alleys, past the apartment buildings and vacant lots, convenience stores and bungalow homes. And as I drove, I remembered. I remembered the whistle of the Illinois Central, bearing the weight of the thousands who had come up from the South so many years before, the black men and women and children, dirty from the soot of the rail cars, clutching their makeshift luggage, all making their way to Canaan land. The mailman I saw was Richard Wright, delivering mail before his first book sold. The little girl with the glasses and pigtails was Regina, skipping rope. I made a chain between my life and the faces I saw, borrowing other people's memories. In this way, I tried to take possession of the city, make it my own. It was during such a drive that I passed Smitty's Barber Shop, a 15-by-30-foot storefront on the edge of Hyde Park, with four barber's chairs and a card table for Letitia, the part-time manicurist. The door was propped open when I walked in, the barbershop smells of hair cream and antiseptic mingling with the sound of men's laughter and the hum of slow fans. Smitty turned out to be an older black man, gray-haired, slender and stooped. His chair was open, and so I took a seat, soon joining in the familiar barbershop banter of sports and women and yesterday's headlines, conversation at once intimate and anonymous, among men who've agreed to leave their troubles outside. Somebody had just finished telling a story about his neighbor. The man had been caught in bed, with his wife's cousin, and chased at the point of a kitchen knife, buck naked, out into the street, when the talk turned to politics. "Verdoliak and the rest of them cracker aldermen don't know when to quit," the man with the newspaper said, shaking his head in disgust. "When old man Daley was mayor, didn't nobody say nothing about him putting all them Irish up in City Hall. But the minute Harold tries to hire some black people, just to even things out, they call it reverse racism. Man, that's how it always is. Whenever a black man gets into power, they're going to try to change the rules on him. Worst part is, newspapers acting like it was black folks that started this whole mess. What you expect from the white man's paper? You right. Harold knows what he's doing, though. Just biding his time till the next election." That's how black people talked about Chicago's mayor, with a familiarity and affection normally reserved for a relative. His picture was everywhere, on the walls of shoe repair shops and beauty parlors, still glued to lampposts from the last campaign, even in the windows of the Korean dry cleaners in the Arab grocery stores, displayed prominently, like some protective totem. From the barbershop wall, that portrait looked down on me now, the handsome grizzled face, the bushy eyebrows and mustache, the twinkle in the eyes. Smitty noticed me looking at the picture and asked if I'd been in Chicago during the election. I told him I hadn't. He nodded his head. "Had to be there before Harold to understand what he means to this city," Smitty said. "Before Harold, seemed like we'd always be second-class citizens." "Plantation politics," the man with the newspaper said. "That's just what it was, too," Smitty said. "A plantation. Black people in the worst jobs, the worst housing, police brutality rampant. But when the so-called black committeemen came around election time, we'd all line up and vote the straight Democratic ticket. Sell our souls for a Christmas turkey. White folks spitting in our faces, and we'd reward them with a vote." Clumps of hair fell into my lap as I listened to the men recall Harold's rise. He had run for mayor once before, shortly after the elder Daley died, but the candidacy had faltered. A source of shame, the men told me, the lack of unity within the black community, the doubts that had to be overcome. But Harold had tried again, and this time the people were ready. They had stuck with him when the press played up the income taxes he'd failed to pay. They'd rallied behind him when white Democratic committeemen, Verdoliak and others, announced their support for the Republican candidate, saying that the city would go to hell if it had a black mayor. They had turned out in record numbers on election night, ministers and gangbangers, young and old. and their faith had been rewarded. Smitty said, "That night Harold won, let me tell you, people just ran the streets. It was like the day Joe Louis knocked out Schmeling. Same feeling. People weren't just proud of Harold, they were proud of themselves. I stayed inside, but my wife and I, we couldn't go to bed until 3, we were so excited. When I woke up the next morning, seemed like the most beautiful day of my life." Smitty's voice had fallen to a whisper, and everyone in the room began to smile. From a distance, reading the newspapers back in New York, I had shared in their pride, the same sort of pride that made me root for any pro football team that fielded a black quarterback. But something was different about what I was hearing now. There was a fervor in Smitty's voice that seemed to go beyond politics. "Had to be here to understand," he had said. He'd meant here in Chicago, but he could also have meant here in my shoes, an older black man who still burns from a lifetime of insults, of foiled ambitions, of ambitions abandoned before they'd been tried. I asked myself if I could truly understand that. I assumed, took for granted, that I could. Seeing me, these men had made the same assumption. Would they feel the same way if they knew more about me? I wondered. I tried to imagine what would happen if Gramps walked into the barber shop at that moment, how the talk would stop, how the spell would be broken, the different assumptions at work. Smitty handed me the mirror to check his handiwork, then pulled off my smock and brushed off the back of my shirt. "Thanks for the history lesson," I said, standing up. "Hey, that bar's free. Haircut's $10. What's your name, anyway?" "Barack." "Barack, huh? You a Muslim?" "My grandfather was." He took the money and shook my hand. "Well, Barack, you should come back a little sooner next time. Your hair was looking awful raggedy when you walked in." Late that afternoon, Marty picked me up in front of my new address and we headed south on the Skyway. After several miles, we took an exit leading into the southeast side, past rows of small houses made of gray clapboard or brick, until we arrived at a massive old factory that stretched out over several blocks. "The old Wisconsin steel plant," Marty announced. We sat there in silence, studying the building. It expressed some of the robust, brutal spirit of Chicago's industrial past. Metal beams and concrete rammed together, without much attention to comfort or detail. Only now it was empty and rust-stained, like an abandoned wreck. On the other side of the chain-link fence, a spotted, mangy cat ran through the weeds. "All kinds of people used to work in the plant," Marty said as he wheeled the car around and started back down the road. "Blacks, whites, Hispanics, all working the same jobs, all living the same kind of lives. But outside the plant, most of them didn't want anything to do with each other. And these are the church people I'm talking about, brothers and sisters in Christ." We came to a stoplight, and I noticed a group of young white men in their undershirts, drinking beer on a stoop. A Verdoliak poster hung in one of the windows, and several of the men began to glare in my direction. I turned to Marty. "So what makes you think they can work together now?" "They don't have a choice," Marty said. "Not if they want their jobs back." As we re-entered the highway, Marty began to tell me more about the organization he'd built. The idea had first come to him 2 years earlier, he said, when he'd read reports of the plant closings and layoffs, then sweeping across South Chicago and the southern suburbs. With the help of a sympathetic Catholic auxiliary bishop, he'd gone to meet with pastors and church members in the area and heard both blacks and whites talk about their shame of unemployment, their fear of losing a house or being cheated out of a pension, their common sense of having been betrayed. Eventually, over 20 churches had agreed to form an organization called Developing Communities Project, or DCP. Things hadn't moved quite as fast as Marty had hoped, the unions hadn't signed on, and the political war in the city council had proven to be a major distraction. Still, DCP had recently won its first significant victory, a $500,000 computerized job placement program that the Illinois legislature had agreed to fund. "We were on our way to a rally to celebrate this new job bank," Marty explained, "the opening shot in a long-term campaign." "It's going to take a while to rebuild manufacturing out here," Marty said. 10 years minimum, but once we get the unions involved, we'll have a base to negotiate from. In the meantime, we just need to stop the hemorrhage and give people some short-term victories. Something to show people how much power they have once they stop fighting each other and start going after the real enemy." "And who's that?" I asked. Marty shrugged. "The investment bankers, the politicians, the fat cat lobbyists." Marty nodded to himself, squinting at the road ahead. Looking at him, I began to suspect that he wasn't as cynical as he liked to make out, that the plant we just left carried a larger meaning for him. Somewhere in his life, I thought, he too had been betrayed.
Context of white supremacy. The number to dial for folks to participate. Again, this is supposed to be a book club, not Gus just rambling and talking, sharing my views, exchange of views. So the number to dial, 760-569-7676, and the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you have questions or would like to participate. If you would like to participate, press star 6. I'll give out the number again. Before I hit the phone lines, as I said, this is the abridged version of the book. This was not quite as bad as last week when we did the study session. And as I said, I felt like there were many, many portions that were left out that were just extremely significant. It wasn't like they were taking out a sentence here or a sentence there. They were taking out whole paragraphs, really. And if I'm recalling correctly, they were taking out whole pages at some point where he was talking explicitly about racism, white supremacy, and what a monumental problem it is. This time, I didn't see as many massive chunks. It would just be a sentence here or there. And this time, it was not as profound what was removed, although there were a few sentences that were of note that they did take out. I'll make sure I get those in, and then I'll check if anyone wants to participate. One of them, I believe this is in chapter 8, when President Obama, he's in the barbershop, and he's talking to the different black males about the local elections, Harold Washington, and what he meant to black people in Chicago, when he says that, just to give some context, when he says Mr. Washington had run for mayor once before, shortly after the elder Daley died, but the candidacy had faltered, a source of shame, the men told me, the lack of unity within the black community, the doubts that had to be overcome. But Harold had tried again, and this time the people were ready. They had stuck with him when the press played up the income taxes he'd failed to pay. The sentence they left out, this is in parentheses, a direct quote, as if this is something that black people were saying, like the white cats don't cheat on every damn thing every minute of their lives. They conveniently omitted that sentence. I thought that was important. One of the other points, this was not omitted, but I just thought this was important. And I remember last week when we were talking about whether or not President Obama, is he confused? Is he confused or is he clear? Is this somebody who has a clear understanding of racism, white supremacy, and it's just being showcased? So white people are showcasing a non-white person who is less confused, and from time to time they allow him to evidence that he is less confused and to speak truthfully. Most of the time they do not. Is that what's going on, or is this a non-white person who is confused, who really doesn't understand the system of white supremacy? Sometimes it seems like they got it, but they do have a white parent, and maybe their white identification kicks in and they end up being not so clear on what's going on. The line where he talks about communities. Wow. He says specifically, communities had never been a given in this country, at least not for blacks. I thought that was real important, and it reminded me of Mr. Fuller when he says there is no black community. I mean, it sounds identical to what I hear Mr. Fuller expressed, and I think there were at least one or two callers last week who were saying that they don't think President Obama is confused. They think he has crystal clarity about the system of white supremacy. I would use that sentence right there as further evidence that I think this person has a great deal, President Obama I'm talking about, has a great deal of understanding about the world in which we live being dominated by white supremacy. I will check, see if anybody to get any hands for folks who would like to share any views. One thing that I also will toss in that I thought was very significant, the segment about his mom, I thought that also revealed quite a bit about the system of racism, white supremacy. That film, Black Orpheus, I have seen that. I snickered, man. I was thinking about Pam, not only the Chicago politics, and this is her area of the world, but the film Black Orpheus. She had been discussing it about, I think about a year ago this time, we were talking about that film. I had already seen it, as President Obama was saying. It is an older film. I know it was very popular in the 70s. It is subtitled. But just hearing the way, the fascination that his white mother had with this film, and hearing him describe her just sitting here and just loving seeing these black people run around and sing songs and all the bright colors amidst all this poverty, by the way. The film is, I believe, either shot or the narrative of the story is that this is going down in Rio. So a lot of poor black people, and she's just, oh, loving. And this is not, in fact, now that I'm remembering the film, I have met other white women who love this film. I know a racist suspect. Her name is Georgia Roberts. She was a professor at the University of Washington. She would do classes on racism. She led a study abroad program where she would take students, 15 to 20 students, to Africa for 3 months. I think they went to South Africa. She had done this for a year. In fact, she was so cunning that the non-white students who are part of this program, when she initially joined the program, Georgia Roberts, she wasn't the head. It was a white man who was head of this program. She was just adjunct faculty assistant to this white man. She went back, reported on him, said he wasn't running the program correctly, and got behind the non-white students who were saying, hey, this white guy is racist, and the way that he's running the program is racist, and we want somebody else to be in charge. She supported the non-white students who were making this accusation, and they ended up putting her in charge of the program, and now she just continues to run it with her brand of racism, white supremacy. And I was told by one of the non-white people on the trip that she, of course, engaged in sexual intercourse with one of the black males while they were in Africa. Not that I want to depart from the story, but I feel like I have met some white women who are very similar to what President Obama is describing about his white mother. I don't know if people out there have seen that film, Black Orpheus, but it is available online. You can check it out. It is pretty good, I think, pretty good film. Anywho, I thought that was just a great portion of the book right there, and really just explaining this. And I would say, again, not being confused. That does not sound like he's talking about his mom. Most of the non-white people that I know, they would not have the ability to pick up on that from just regular white people that they don't have any sort of emotional connection to. If it was a quote-unquote white friend, or they're just looking at some white people who really like this film and are talking about whatever adulation they have for this black film, I think there are a significant number of black people that would go completely over their head. They would not pick up on that at all. And the fact that he got this and he's talking about his mom, and you would think there would be some emotions to not scrutinize a parent in that manner. But that's the second time that I've seen that in this book. I remember last week where he said he felt that his mom had done an experiment on him. I thought just the use of that word, experiment, is another case where, in my view, that is pretty sophisticated level of insight about the ways racism, white supremacy can operate, even with it being a white parent. Just thought that was a great scene. He says, and he references Joseph Conrad once again. It's the third time I think that's come up in the book, when he says, this is, my pages don't match up. I have the PDF, so my pages aren't really matching up correctly. But when he writes, her face, lit by the blue glow of the screen, was set in a wistful gaze. At that moment, I felt as if I were being given a window into her heart. the unreflective heart of her youth. I suddenly realized that the depiction of childlike blacks I was now seeing on the screen, the reverse image of Joseph Conrad's Dark Savages, was what my mother had carried with her to Hawaii all those years before, a reflection of the simple fantasies that had been forbidden to a white middle-class girl from Kansas, the promise of another life, warm, sensual, exotic, different. I turned away, embarrassed for her, irritated with the people around me. Really interesting scene, in my view. Fascinating scene. And they didn't take that one out, left it in. Wow. Quite a passage, in my opinion. And I think A plus. I think Dr. Welsing, when I shared one of the passages, she said A plus seems like a very accurate analysis. And I would just say, now keep that in mind with the fact that, okay, now this white woman has gone around the globe having sexual intercourse with non-white people, producing children with them, and then divorcing and moving on. She makes a point of making sure to emphasize that she was the one that divorced President Obama's father. Then she gets upset with Lolo. I remember last week you were hearing more details around that, about how her being a white person and just that it's just no way. He says it again this week, and just talking about the relationship with his mom and his dad and the difficulty of a black person and a white person having some sort of authentic quality relationship under a system of white supremacy. Accurate through and through. Now, I don't know if this is going to come up, or actually it does. I know it's going to come up when he talks about his own sexual experiences with white women. I don't know if that's in the audio for this week. I don't even know if they left that in the audio book, but that should be coming up again. And I would just emphasize, hey, I don't hear that come from a lot of non-white people. I hear a lot of non-white people, and that totally goes over their head. They just think this is wonderful, and this is an example of racism coming down. Real important segment, in my view. The folks that dialed in, I think we have Praz and B-More. Your lines are open. Anybody else that dials in, I'll open your line as I see the hands. B-More and Praz, you should be with us.
Greetings, Gus. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I wanted to comment on the film Black Orpheus. I watched that recently, and then I saw they had a behind-the-scenes where they interviewed people who were knowledgeable about production, and it actually wasn't a Brazilian film. It was a French film. So in a sense, it was a French perspective on Brazil. And I think some comments made were that some Brazilians were unhappy with it because it was giving the wrong image regarding their culture. And in a sense, it was sort of being, you know, making it like the people in poverty were happiest. And I can kind of relate that to another film, Burr Rabbit, you know, where the slaves were on the plantation and they were just happy and singing. And it seems like this kind of concept would appeal to a racist man and racist woman. It would please them, in other words.
Excellent analysis, in my opinion. I think racial theater, I think white people, they have a real affinity for racial theater. There's no addressing why all the black people in Brazil are in poverty. No one gives an explanation as to why that is. They're just happy and running around, singing songs, and it's carnival. You know, it's a great big party, and you just get to see, for the most part, black people having fun. And in fact, I would even throw in one of our popular terms for the cows, necrophilia, because the two main black characters, they do die. So they have their sexual relationship, but they do die at the end of it. That, I'm sure, is a part of the racial theater for why these white people enjoy the film. The black people don't exactly run off into the sunset, live happily ever after, and have 10, 20 children. That doesn't go down in Black Orpheus.
Peace, Gus, and all the other listeners. Oh, sorry, Father, were you going to speak?
Oh, no, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I noted several things that you all spoke of, so I won't be redundant. But one thing that I did note, I don't think you all mentioned, was how he was talking about the emotions between races can never be pure. And I believe he used three adjectives. He said, well, menacing, alien, and apart. And although we haven't gotten to his whole relationships with, like, in tragic arrangements, or the tragic arrangements and things like that, I was kind of taking notes and assuming that that's why he chose a non-white female, or that's why he's with a non-white female, First Lady Michelle Obama, because here he is a product of a tragic arrangement, but he knows that, you know, as he said, emotions between races can never be pure. So that's one thing that I took note of.
Mm-hmm. Excellent point. I highlighted that as well. And that's connected to his commentary about Black Orpheus. It's just a couple lines down where he says, I pulled out my highlighter for that one. The emotions between the races could never be pure. Even love was tarnished by the desire to find in the other some element that was missing in ourselves. Whether we sought out our demons or salvation, the other race would always remain just that, menacing, alien, and apart. And I would just say that that is accurate, except there's only one race. So when he says the other race, I would just say white people will always remain menacing and alien. It is not non-white people. I don't think non-white people have a history of being menacing and alien with regards to white people. It is white people who do the menacing and function as non-human aliens on the planet.
I agree.
Yeah, I agree. It seems that non-white people, as long as we aren't mistreated, I think we're pretty much okay. You know, we're comfortable. But, I mean, they can't even give us that much.
Yeah, this is in Chapter 6. If anyone is following along, the Black Orpheus and about the lack of pure emotions. Tarnished is in the word guide, too. Mr. Fuller talks about the use of that. He advises against the use of that word. But yeah, all of this is at the close of Chapter 6. I also thought it was significant just in terms of omissions when he, this is at the beginning of Chapter 7, when he says, my memories of Indonesia with its beggars and farmers and loss of Lolo to power and through Ray and Regina, my move to New York, my father's death, I can see that my choices were never truly mine alone, and that is how it should be. That to assert otherwise is to chase after a sorry sort of freedom. They omitted Frank and Marcus. Marcus was the, overweight black male that he was in high school with in Hawaii. They used to have a lot of conversations about racism. That was in the audio segment from last week. They omitted both of their names from this list when he was talking about some of the people that had influenced his life and choices. I thought that was significant as well.
Yeah, I don't know, in commenting on his mom, I think of that scene where they're watching the film. And it seems like Barack, even at a young age, is kind of sort of feeling upset that his mom is falling in love with a stereotype. And I think that, I have to refer back to Invisible Man, where he's in the room with, you know, they put him on the women issue, and the woman is trying to seduce him. And then he ends up not sleeping with her, and then he writes, you just got raped by Santa Claus. So they're like, I remember you had a show about that before. You know, he sees in his mom this love, this negrophilia, that's just based upon stereotypes and a lot of racist concepts of what black people are. They're not human beings. They're just happily singing and, you know, they're not real people. Sort of like toys you can just play with and put away when you're finished.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great reference. Great reference. I think that is accurate. Did go ahead.
Oh no, I said you just wondered like how his her relationship was with his father and Lolo. I mean, did they get to a point where they're like, well, you like me, you know, but it's just a surface type of thing, and it's not, you know, it's not real. And sort of like when you get to know me, okay, well, then you don't like it anymore. When I become a real person. Once the fetishism wears off, you have to deal with the personality, a real person. Yeah, that was all.
Back to the interview. Sorry, Gus. But back to the interview. Did the interviewer that was interviewing President Obama, did she say that when he went to Kenya, his sister was taking him into the dark about his father? Did anybody else note that?
I remember the term dark was used. I think that might be correct. I remember the term, she said the term dark when she was in the context of him going back to Kenya. And yes, I think I might be off, but that sounds accurate. I definitely remember her using the term dark in that context. I think that is accurate.
Okay. I definitely wrote that down as well too. But yeah, that's what I wanted to talk about. That white people use the word.
Yeah. That interview is. You can check that out, man. I don't think I played the whole thing. I played like the first 10 minutes of it last week, and a different 10 minutes of it. But you can check out the whole thing. It is. Fascinating. Connie Martinson, that's her name, Racist Suspect. Did anything stand out? To me, it was quite deja vu hearing his explanation of how black people were responding to Harold Washington in Chicago. It was fast. Like, I don't know. Just hearing the way that they responded and how they got up the next morning, and he said it was the most beautiful day ever. The black male was describing after Mr. Washington won his election in Chicago. I'm not into coincidences. It was a bit much after what I have seen this week and what I remember from 2008. The response of black people how black people respond to a black person winning some sort of political office where they think this represents a triumph over racism, white supremacy. And I think even more importantly, I know I was talking to Pam and she was saying it's like the insult. I think they talked about that, the insults that black people have to deal with on a constant basis, from being mistreated as victims of racism. They're just getting something, anything, even if it's just a symbolic victory, something that makes them feel a little bit better. I think they talked about Joe Louis when he knocked out Max Schmeling, just an athlete, anything, doesn't matter what it is. As long as it's a black person, just having the appearance that they might be doing well means so much to black people. And it was just stunning to hear that. And given what we have seen this week, did anybody else have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think he kind of hits it on the head when he says, he said, Marty put his glasses back on and met my stare. It's not a question of fault, he said. It's a question of whether any politician, even somebody with Harold's talent, can do much to break the cycle. So it's kind of like the cycle. I mean, I think what Marty meant was maybe white supremacy, the cycle of white supremacy. No matter how good you are as an individual person, you're no match for a system.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What did you all make of his relationship with this Marty? I know we haven't heard too much. I'm sure we'll get more as we roll along. What did you all make of this character and his relationship with President Obama so far?
He's kind of a mentor to him, it seems. And I know when you go to a barbershop, in the black community, at least, that's where you get all the information about what's going on, what people are talking about. You know, it's always been the barbershop.
That line when he's talking, this is from the barbershop scene, when he says, plantation politics, man. Woo-wee. Plantation politics. That's just what it is, too, Smitty said. A plantation. Black people in the worst jobs, the worst housing, police brutality rampant. But when the so-called black committeemen came around election time, we'd all line up and vote the straight Democratic ticket. Sell our soul for a Christmas turkey. White folks spitting in our faces, and we'd reward them with the vote. I feel like I heard some sentiment expressed that was pretty similar to that this week as well. I think, in fact, it might have even been Pam who was saying they've been doing a lot of blaming black people, fussing. We'll talk about this more tomorrow, but blaming black people and fussing at them. White people that I've heard been doing this, saying it was black people who voted for him and they're racist. They just voted for him because he's black. And I think Pam made the point that black people tend to just vote Democratic, and white people have known this for a long time. It doesn't matter who the candidate is, if it's a white person, if it's a non-white person. If black people vote, they tend to vote in mass for the Democrat, regardless of whether they say anything, do anything for black people. That just has been what it is for a long, long time now, since the so-called civil rights movement. Sell our soul for a Christmas turkey. White folks spitting in our faces, and we'd reward them with the vote. I think they know it's been like that for a long time.
I think he admitted there was after they rallied behind him with a when white Democratic committeemen, then it said Verdolek and others announced their support for the Republican candidate. I think he left that out. I think he just said saying the city would go to hell if it had a black mayor. So. In addition to the other line that said, like, the white cats don't cheat on every damn thing every minute of their lives. Yeah.
Just one little sentence here and there. I would be curious as to who did the editing. Like, who was it, a group? What people sat down and went through this and picked out what stuff was going to stay in the audiobook, what stuff they were going to cut, how long they wanted it. I'd be very curious if anybody knows anything about the process of how the audiobook came together. I know it was published in 2005, but I would be very interested to if there's comment, if he's done any interviews, or if anybody gets any info on that. Definitely share. I'd be interested to see that. If Any other comments? Anything else folks want to make sure they get in before we go to audio segment number two? I will again encourage, if you are listening to the program, have the book out. Like I said, this week it hasn't been as bad as last week. I haven't seen whole pages removed last week. It was lots and lots of material that was removed. It hasn't been quite that bad this week, but as our listener just Praz just pointed out, there have been some important sentences that have been snatched here and there. But definitely be following along if you can, if you have the book. Just kind of be listening and reading along to make sure I might miss something or, you know, what have you. Even if I don't miss it, I think you would I think you'll be surprised if you have the ability to have the book in front of you, just to see how much material got left out and then to see what material didn't make it to the book, if you think that's something that's important or not. But any of the folks listening in or any of the folks that are on the line, anything else you want to get in before we go to segment number two? Cool beans. I will give out the number again once we finish up with the second segment. If you've been listening in, I hope people don't wait till the last minute. We had a lot of that last week. Do not wait till the last minute. If you've been taking notes and following along, you think you might want to share, jot it down. I'll hit the phone lines once the second segment of the audio finishes, and hopefully people will not wait until 7 p.m. Eastern to decide that they have a few things that they want to get in. I don't know if it's in the audio segment this week, and I don't know if they... maybe they cut it out, but I believe President Obama, in fact, I would put some money down. I remember from reading that he had explicit dialogue once he was having his own experiences playing in the snow, being sexually sewered. And the same thing came up, the same thing that we heard with his mom and Lolo, his mom and his father, her response to Black Orpheus. These same issues come up again, and he starts to talk explicitly about how he could not be married to a white woman, how he had to be, if he was going to be married and have children and all that, had to be with a black female. I remember that distinctly coming up in the book. I will be interested to see if that is left in the audiobook, if they edit it. I'll be looking. That should be coming up maybe this week. If not this week, it'll be, I would think, early next week, because it seems to be about where it is when he was in Colombia. So I don't know. We'll have to see. We'll have to see where it comes up. Oh, I take that back. I don't know if it's while he was at Harvard or Columbia. So we'll have to see. I will be keeping my eye on the book, trying to highlight, make sure we don't miss anything that they have snatched out. I hope other people will as well. And again, I will give out the number once we finish up with the audio segment. This second clip, it's about same length, about 35 minutes or so. Sit back, get your tea or coffee, whatever the case may be. I hope you are as comfortable as one can be on the plantation. I hope this is a constructive investment of your Friday evening. We will begin segment two, President Barack Obama, Dreams from My Father.
It was twilight by the time we crossed the city line and pulled into the parking lot of a large suburban school, where crowds of people were already making their way into the auditorium. They appeared as Marty had described them, laid-off steel workers, secretaries, and truck drivers, men and women who smoked a lot and didn't watch their weight, shopped at Sears or Kmart, drove late-model cars from Detroit, and ate at Red Lobster on special occasions. A barrel-chested black man in a cleric's collar greeted us at the door, and Marty introduced him as Deacon Wilbur Milton, co-president of the organization. "Welcome," Will said, pumping my hand. "We've been wondering when we'd actually get to meet you. Thought maybe Marty just made you up." Marty peeked inside the auditorium. "How's turnout looking?" "Good so far. Everybody seems to be making their quota. Governor's people just called to say he's on his way." Marty and Will began walking towards the stage, their heads buried in the evening's agenda. I started to follow them, but found my path blocked by three black women of indeterminate age. One of them, a pretty woman with orange-tinted hair, introduced herself as Angela, then leaned over to me and whispered, "You're Barack, aren't you?" I nodded. "You don't know how glad we are to see you." "You really don't," the older woman next to Angela said. I offered the woman my hand, and she smiled to show off a gold front tooth. "I'm sorry," she said, taking my hand. "I'm Shirley." She gestured towards the last woman, dark and heavy-set. This is Mona. Don't he look clean-cut, Mona?
Sure does, Mona said with a laugh.
Don't get me wrong, Angela said, her voice still lowered a pitch. I've got nothing against Marty, but the fact is, there's only so far you can—
Hey, Angela!
We looked up to see Marty waving at us from the stage. You guys can talk to Barack all you want later. Right now I need all of you up here with me. The auditorium was almost filled by this time, 2,000 people in all, maybe a third of them black bust in from the city. A procession of speakers then mounted the stage, a black legislator and a white legislator, a Baptist minister and Cardinal Bernardine, and finally the governor, who offered his solemn pledge of support for the new job bank and recited evidence of his tireless efforts on behalf of the working men and women of Illinois. Seeing all these black and white faces together in one place, I found myself feeling cheered, recognizing in myself the same vision driving Marty, his confidence in the populist impulse and working-class solidarity, his faith that if you could just clear away the politicians and media and bureaucrats and give everybody a seat at the table, then ordinary people could find common ground. The day after the rally, Marty decided it was time for me to do some real work, and he handed me a long list of people to interview. Find out their self-interest, he said. That's why people become involved in organizing, because they think they'll get something out of it. Once I found an issue enough people cared about, I could take them into action. With enough actions, I could start to build power. I was worried at first about people's willingness to meet and talk with me, but after a few phone calls, I found that people didn't mind a chance to air their opinions about a do-nothing alderman or the neighbor who refused to mow his lawn. The more interviews I did, the more I began to hear certain recurring themes. I learned, for example, that most of the people in the area had been raised farther north, or on Chicago's west side, in the cramped black enclaves the restrictive covenants had created for most of the city's history. The people I talked to had some fond memories of that self-contained world, but they also remembered the absence of heat and light and space to breathe, that and the sight of their parents grinding out life in physical labor. A few had followed their parents into the steel mills or onto the assembly line, but many more had found jobs as mail carriers, bus drivers, teachers, and social workers, taking advantage of the more rigorous enforcement of anti-discrimination laws in the public sector. Such jobs had benefits and provided enough security to think about taking on a mortgage. With the passage of fair housing laws, they began to buy homes, one at a time, in Roseland and other white neighborhoods. Not because they were necessarily interested in mingling with whites, they insisted, but because the houses there were affordable, with small yards for their children, because the schools were better and the stores cheaper, and maybe just because they could. Often, as I listened to these stories, I would find myself reminded of the stories that Gramps and Toot and my mother had told, stories of hardship and migration, the drive for something better. But there was an inescapable difference between what I was hearing now and what I remembered, as if the images of my childhood had been run in reverse. In these new stories, for sale signs cropped up like dandelions under a summer sun. Stones flew through windows, and the strained voices of anxious parents could be heard calling children indoors from innocent games. Entire blocks turned over in less than 6 months. Entire neighborhoods in less than 5 years. In these stories, wherever black and white met, the result was sure to be anger and grief. The area had never fully recovered from this racial upheaval. The stores and banks had left with their white customers, causing main thoroughfares to decompose. City services had declined. Still, when the blacks who now lived in their homes for 10 or 15 years looked back on the way things had turned out, they did so with some measure of satisfaction. On the strength of two incomes, they had paid off house notes and car notes, maybe college educations, for the sons or daughters whose graduation pictures filled every mantelpiece. They had kept their homes up and kept their children off the streets. They had formed block clubs to make sure that others did too. It was when they spoke of the future that a certain disquiet entered their voices. They would mention a cousin or sibling who came by every so often asking for money, or an adult child, unemployed, who still lived at home. Even the success of those children who'd made it through college and into the white-collar world harbored within it an element of loss. The better these children did, the more likely they were to move away. In their place, younger, less stable families moved in. The second wave of migrants from poorer neighborhoods, newcomers who couldn't always afford to keep up with their mortgage payments, or invest in periodic maintenance. Car thefts were up. The leafy parks were empty. People began to spend more time inside. They invested in elaborate wrought iron doors. They wondered if they could afford to sell at a loss and retire to a warmer climate, perhaps move back to the South. So despite the deserved sense of accomplishment these men and women felt, despite the irrefutable evidence of their own progress, our conversations were marked by another, more ominous strain. The boarded-up homes, the decaying storefronts, the aging church rolls, kids from unknown families who swaggered down the streets, loud congregations of teenage boys, teenage girls feeding potato chips to crying toddlers, the discarded wrappers tumbling down the block, all of it whispered painful truths, told them the progress they'd found was ephemeral, rooted in thin soil, that it might not even last their lifetimes. And it was this dual sense of individual advancement and collective decline that I thought accounted for some of the most troubling attitudes I heard in some conversations. I heard it in the excessive pride some of the men took in their well-stocked bars they'd built in their basements, with the lava lamps and the mirrored walls, in the protective plastic that the women kept over their spotless carpets and sofas. In all of it, one saw a determined effort to shore up the belief that things had in fact changed, if only some people would start acting right. "I try to avoid driving through Rosen when I can," a woman from neighboring Washington Heights explained to me one evening. "People down there are just rougher. You can see it in the way they keep up their homes. You didn't see things like that when the white folks still lived there." Distinctions between neighborhoods, then blocks, then finally neighbors within a block. Attempts to cordon off, control the decay. One thing I noticed, though, the woman so concerned with the cruder habits of her neighbors had a picture of Harold in her kitchen, right next to the sampler of the 23rd Psalm. So did the young man who lived in the crumbling apartment a few blocks away and was trying to make ends meet by mixing records at dance parties. As it had for the men in Smitty's barbershop, the election had given both these people a new idea of themselves. Or maybe it was an old idea, born of a simpler time. Harold was something they held in common. Like my idea of organizing, he held out an offer of collective redemption. During a meeting with Ruby Stiles, a stocky woman who worked as an office manager on the north side of the city, we had been talking about her teenage son Kyle, a bright but diffident boy who was starting to have trouble at school, when she mentioned the rise in local gang activity. One of Kyle's friends had been shot just last week, she said, right in front of his house. The boy was all right, but now Ruby was worried about her own son's safety. Over the next few days, I had Ruby introduce me to other parents who shared her fears and felt frustrated over the lackluster police response. When I suggested that we invite the district commander to a neighborhood meeting so the community could air its concerns, everyone agreed, and as we talked about publicity, one of the women mentioned that there was a Baptist church on the block where the boy had been shot, and that a pastor there, a Reverend Reynolds, might be willing to make an announcement to his congregation. It took me a week of phone calls, but when I finally reached Reverend Reynolds, his response seemed promising. He was the president of the local ministerial alliance. He said that the group would be holding its regular meeting the very next day, and that he would be happy to put me on the agenda. I hung up the phone full of excitement and arrived at Reverend Reynolds' church early the next morning. We all sat around a long table, and Reverend Reynolds led us in prayer before offering me the floor. Suppressing my nerves, I told the ministers about the increasing gang activity and the meeting we had planned, and passed out flyers for them to distribute to their congregations. Just as I passed out the last flyers, a tall, pecan-colored man entered the room. He wore a blue, double-breasted suit and a large gold cross against his scarlet tie. His hair was straightened and swept back in a pompadour. "Brother Smalls, you just missed an excellent presentation," Reverend Reynolds said. "This young man, Brother Obama, has a plan to organize a meeting about the recent gang shooting." Reverend Smalls poured himself a cup of coffee and perused the flyer. "What's the name of your organization?" he asked me. "Developing Communities Project." "Developing Communities," his brow knotted. "I think I remember some white man coming around here talking about some developing something or other. Funny-looking guy. Jewish name. You connected to the Catholics?" I told him that some of the Catholic churches in the area were involved. "That's right, I remember now." Reverend Smalls sipped his coffee and leaned back in his chair. "I told that white man he might as well pack up and get on out of here. We don't need anything like this around here. Listen, what's your name again? Obama? Listen, Obama, you may mean well. I'm sure you do.
But the last thing we need is to join up with a bunch of white money and Catholic churches and Jewish organizers to solve our problems. They're not interested in us. Shoot, the archdiocese in this city is run by stone-cold racists. Always has been. White folks coming in here think that they know what's best for us, hiring a bunch of high-talking, college-educated brothers like yourself who don't know no better, and all they want to do is take over. It's all a political thing, and that's not what this group here is about. I stammered that the church had always taken the lead in addressing community issues, but Reverend Smalls just shook his head. You don't understand, he said. Things have changed with the new mayor. I've known the district police commander since he was a beat cop. The aldermen in this area are all committed to black empowerment. Why we need to be protesting and carrying on at our own people? Anybody sitting around this table got a direct line to City Hall. Fred, didn't you just talk to the alderman about getting a permit for your parking lot? The rest of the room had grown quiet. Reverend Small smiled and patted me on the shoulder. Don't misunderstand me now. Like I said, I know you mean well. We need some young blood to help out with the cause. All I'm saying is that right now, you're on the wrong side of the battle. I sat there, roasting like a pig on a spit, as the pastors went on to discuss a joint Thanksgiving service in the park across the street. When the meeting was over, Reverend Reynolds and a few others thanked me for coming. Don't take Charles too seriously, one of them advised. He can be a little strong sometimes. But I noticed none of them left with my flyers, and later in the week, when I tried to call some of the ministers back, their secretaries kept telling me they were gone for the day. We went forward with our police meeting, which proved a small disaster. Only 13 people showed up, scattered across rows of empty chairs. The district commander canceled on us, sending a community relations officer instead. Every few minutes, an older couple walked in looking for the bingo game. I spent most of the evening directing this wayward traffic upstairs while Ruby sat glumly on stage, listening to the policeman lecture about the need for parental discipline. About halfway through the meeting, Marty arrived. After it was over, he came up and put a hand on my shoulder. Feels like shit, huh? It did. He helped me clean up, then took me out for coffee and pointed out some of my mistakes. The problem of gangs was too general to make an impression on people, he said. Issues had to be made concrete, specific, winnable. I should have prepared Ruby more carefully and set out fewer chairs. Most importantly, I needed to spend more time getting to know the leaders in the community. Flyers couldn't pull people out on a rainy night. That reminds me, he said as we stood up. Whatever happened to those pastors you were supposed to be meeting with? I told him about Reverend Smalls. He started to laugh. Guess it's a good thing I didn't tag along, huh? I wasn't amused. Why didn't you warn me about Smalls? I did warn you, Marty said, opening the door to his car. I told you Chicago's polarized and the politicians use it to their own advantage. That's all Smalls is, a politician who happens to wear a collar. Anyway, it's not the end of the world. You should just be glad you learned your lesson early. Watching Marty drive away, I thought back to the day of the rally. The rows of black and white faces in the school auditorium, there because of the factory's desolation and Marty's own sense of betrayal. The cardinal, a small, pale, unassuming man in a black robe and glasses, smiling on stage as Will swallowed them up in a big bear hug. Will, so certain that the two men understood each other. Each image carried its own lesson. Each was subject to differing interpretations. For there were many churches, many faiths. There were times, perhaps, when those faiths seemed to converge. The crowd in front of the Lincoln Memorial, the Freedom Riders at the lunch counter. But such moments were partial, fragmentary. With our eyes closed, we uttered the same words, but in our hearts we each prayed to our own masters. We each remained locked in our own memories. A man like Reverend Smalls understood that people didn't want the victory of Harold's election, their victory, qualified. They wouldn't want to hear that their problems were more complicated than a group of devious white aldermen, or that their redemption was incomplete. Both Marty and Smalls knew that in politics, like religion, power lay in certainty, and that one man's certainty always threatened another's. I realized then, standing in an empty McDonald's parking lot in the south side of Chicago, that I was a heretic. Or worse, for even a heretic must believe in something, if nothing more than the truth of his own doubt. The Altgeld Gardens public housing project sat at Chicago's southernmost edge. 2,000 apartments, arranged in a series of two-story brick buildings, with army green doors and grimy mock shutters. To the east, on the other side of the expressway, was the Lake Calumet landfill, the largest in the Midwest. And to the north, directly across the street, was the Metropolitan Sanitary District's sewage treatment plant.
The people of Otgild couldn't see the plant or the open-air vats that went on for close to a mile. As part of a recent beautification effort, the district maintained a long wall of earth in front of the facility. But officials could do nothing to hide the smell, a heavy, putrid odor that varied in strength depending on the temperature and the wind's direction, and seeped through windows no matter how tightly they were shut. The stench, the toxins, the empty, uninhabited landscape. For close to a century, the few square miles surrounding Otgild had taken on the offal of scores of factories, the price people had paid for their high-wage factory jobs. Now that the jobs were gone, and those people that could had already left, it seemed only natural to use the land as a dump. A dump and a place to house poor blacks. Otgild may have been unique in its physical isolation, but it shared with the city's other projects a common history. The dreams of reformers to build decent housing for the poor, the politics that had concentrated such housing away from white neighborhoods and prevented working families from living there, the use of the Chicago Housing Authority, the CHA, as a patronage trough, the subsequent mismanagement and neglect. It wasn't as bad as Chicago's high-rise projects yet, the Robert Taylors and Cambrini Greens with their ink-black stairwells and urine-stained lobbies and random shootings. Altgeld's occupancy rate held steady at 90%, and if you went inside the apartments, you would more often than not find them well-kept, with small touches, a patterned cloth thrown over torn upholstery, an old calendar left hanging on the wall for its tropical beach scenes that expressed the lingering idea of home. Still, everything about the garden seemed in a perpetual state of disrepair. Ceilings crumbled, pipes burst, toilets backed up, muddy tire tracks branded the small brown lawns strewn with empty flower planters, broken, tilted, half buried. The CHA maintenance crews had stopped even pretending that repairs would happen anytime soon, so that most children in Otgild grew up without ever having seen a garden, children who could see only that things were used up, and that there was a certain pleasure in speeding up the decay. I took a turn into Otgild at 131st, and came to a stop in front of Our Lady of the Gardens Church, a flat brick building towards the rear of the development. I was there to meet some of our key leaders, to talk about the problems of our organizing effort, and how we might get things back on track. Over 2 months had passed since the botched police meeting, and things had gone badly. There had been no marches, no sit-ins, no freedom songs, just a series of miscues and misunderstandings, tedium and stress. Part of the problem was our base, which, in the city at least, had never been large. 8 Catholic parishes flung across several neighborhoods, all with black congregations, but all led by white priests. "The truth is," one of the priests told me, "most of us are out here looking to get a transfer. The only reason I'm still around is that nobody's willing to replace me." Morale was even worse among the laity, black folks like Angela, Shirley, and Mona, the three women I'd met at the rally. They were spirited, good-humored women, those three, women who, without husbands to help, somehow managed to raise sons and daughters, juggle an assortment of part-time jobs and small business schemes, and organized Girl Scout troops, fashion shows, and summer camps for the parade of children that wandered through the church every day. Since none of the three actually lived in Otgild, they all owned small houses just west of the project, I'd asked them once what motivated them to do what they did. Before I could finish the question, they had all rolled their eyes as if on cue. "Watch out, girl," Angela told Shirley, causing Mona to chuckle merrily. "Barack's about to interview you. He's got that look." And Shirley said, "We're just a bunch of bored, middle-aged women, Barack, with nothing better to do with our time. But," and here Shirley threw a hand on her bony hip and raised her cigarette to her lips like a movie star, "if Mr. Wright comes along, then watch out. It's goodbye, Otgild. Hello, Monte Carlo." I hadn't heard any jokes from them lately, though. All I'd heard were complaints. The women complained that Marty didn't care about Otgild. They complained that Marty was arrogant and didn't listen to their suggestions. Most of all, they complained about the new job bank that we had announced with such fanfare the night of the rally, but that had turned out to be a bust. As Marty had planned it, a state university out in the suburbs had been assigned to run the program. It was a matter of efficiency, he explained, since the university had the computers already in place. Unfortunately, 2 months after it was supposed to have started, no one had found work through the program. The computers didn't work right. The data entry was plagued with errors. People were sent to interviews for jobs that didn't exist. Marty was livid, and at least once a week he would have to drive out to the university, cursing under his breath as he tried to pry answers out of officials who seemed more concerned with next year's funding cycle. But the women from Otgild weren't interested in Marty's frustrations. All they knew was that $500,000 had gone somewhere, and it wasn't in their neighborhood. For them, the job bank became yet more evidence that Marty had used them to push a secret agenda, that somehow whites in the suburbs were getting the jobs they'd been promised. "Marty's just looking out for his own," they grumbled. I tried my best to mediate the conflict, defending Marty against charges of racism, suggesting to him that he cultivate more tact. Marty told me I was wasting my time. According to him, the only reason Angela and the other leaders in the city were sore was because he'd refused to hire them to run the program. That's what ruins a lot of so-called community organizations out here. They start taking government money, they hire big do-nothing staffs. Pretty soon they become big patronage operations with clients to be serviced. Not leaders, clients to be serviced. He spit out the words as if they were unclean. Jesus, it makes you sick just thinking about it. Winter came, and the city turned monochrome. Black trees against gray sky above white earth. Night now fell in mid-afternoon, especially when the snowstorms rolled in. Boundless prairie storms that set the sky close to the ground. The city lights reflected against the clouds. The work was tougher in such weather. Mounds of fine white powder blew through the cracks of my car, down my collar and into the openings of my coat. On rounds of interviews, I never spent enough time in one place to thaw properly, and parking spaces became scarce on the snow-narrowed streets. Everyone, it seemed, had a cautionary tale about fights breaking out over parking spaces after a heavy snow, the resulting brawl or shooting. Attendance at evening meetings became more sporadic. People called at the last minute to say they had the flu or their car wouldn't start. Those who did come looked damp and resentful. At times, driving home from such evenings, with the northern gusts off the lake shaking my car across the lane dividers, I would momentarily forget where I was, my thoughts a numbed reflection of the silence. Marty suggested that I take more time off, build a life for myself away from the job. His concerns were professionally explained. Without some personal support outside the work, an organizer lost perspective and could quickly burn out. There was something to what he said, for it was true that the people I met on the job were generally much older than I was, with a set of concerns and demands that created barriers to friendship. When I wasn't working, the weekends would usually find me alone in an empty apartment, making do with the company of books. I didn't heed Marty's advice, though, perhaps because, as the bonds between myself and the leadership grew stronger, I found them offering more than simple friendship. After meetings, I might go with one of the men to a local tavern, to watch the news or listen to oldies, the Temptations, the OJs, thump from a dinged-up corner jukebox. On Sunday, I'd visit a church service and let the women tease me over my confusion with communion and prayer. At a Christmas party, I danced with women old enough to be my mother. I talked sports over stale cheese puffs and meatballs with husbands who had been reluctantly dragged to the affair. I counseled sons or daughters on their college applications and played with grandchildren who sat on my knee. It was during such times, when familiarity or wariness dissolved the lines between organizer and those I was supposed to be organizing, that I learned the most about the work I had chosen. I learned that the self-interest I was supposed to be looking for extended well beyond the immediacy of issues, that beneath the small talk and sketchy biographies and received opinions, people carried within them some central explanation of themselves, stories full of terror and wonder, studded with events that still haunted or inspired them. Sacred stories. Not to say that everything I learned from the leaders cheered my heart. If they often revealed a strength of spirit I hadn't imagined, they also forced me to acknowledge the unspoken forces that retarded our efforts, secrets that we kept from each other as well as from ourselves. That's how it was with Ruby, for example. After our aborted meeting with the police commander, I had worried that she might back away from organizing. Instead, she had thrown herself headlong into the project, working hard to build a network of neighbors that could be regularly delivered to our events, coming up with ideas for registering voters, or working with school parents. She was what every organizer dreamed about, someone with untapped talent, smart, steady, excited by the idea of a public life, eager to learn. And I liked her son, Kyle Jr. He had just turned 14, and in all of his awkwardness, one moment frisky and bumping into me while we shot baskets together in the neighborhood park, the next instant bored and sullen, I could see all the contours of my own youthful struggles. Sometimes Ruby would question me about him, exasperated with a mediocre report card or a cut on his chin, baffled by a young man's unruly mind. Last week he said he was going to be a rap artist, she would report. Today he tells me he's going into the Air Force Academy to be a fighter pilot. When I asked him why, he just says, so I can fly, like I was stupid. I swear, Barack, sometimes I don't know whether to hug him or beat his skinny behind. Try both, I would tell her. One day, just before Christmas, I asked Ruby to stop by my office so I could give her a present for Kyle. I was on the phone when she walked in, and out of the corner of my eye I thought I saw something different about her, but I couldn't quite put my finger on what it was. Only after I had hung up and she turned toward me did I realize that her eyes, normally a warm, dark brown that matched the color of her skin, had turned an opaque shade of blue, as if someone had glued plastic buttons over her irises. She asked me if something was wrong. What'd you do to your eyes? Oh, these. Ruby shook her head and laughed. They're just contacts, Barack. The company I work for makes cosmetic lenses, and I get them at a discount. Do you like them? Your eyes look just fine the way they were. It's just for fun, she said, looking down. Something different, you know? I stood there not knowing what to say. Finally, I remembered Kyle's gift and handed it to Ruby. For Kyle, I said. A book on airplanes. I thought he might like it. Ruby nodded and put the book inside her purse. That's nice of you, Barack. I'm sure he will. Then, abruptly, she stood up and straightened her skirt. Well, I better be going, she said, and hurried out the door. For the rest of the day and into the next, I thought about Ruby's eyes. I'd handled the moment badly, I told myself, made her feel ashamed for a small vanity, in a life that could afford few vanities. I realized that a part of me expected her and the other leaders to possess some sort of immunity from the onslaught of images that feed every American's insecurities. The slender models in the fashion magazines, the square-jawed men in fast cars, images to which I myself was vulnerable, and from which I had sought protection. When I mentioned the incident to a black woman friend of mine, she stated the issue more bluntly. What are you surprised about? My friend said impatiently. The black people still hate themselves? No, I told her, it wasn't exactly surprise that I was feeling. Since my first frightening discovery of bleaching creams in Life magazine, I'd become familiar with the lexicon of color consciousness within the black community. Good hair, bad hair, thick lips or thin, if you're light, you're all right, if you're black, get back. In college, the politics of black fashion and the questions of self-esteem that fashion signified had been a frequent, if delicate, topic of conversation for black students, especially among the women, who would smile bitterly at the sight of the militant brother who always seemed to be dating light-skinned girls, and tongue-lash any black man who was foolish enough to make a remark about a black woman's hairstyle. Mostly, I had kept quiet when these subjects were broached, privately measuring my own degree of infection. But I noticed that such conversations rarely took place in large groups, and never in front of whites. Later, I would realize that the position of most black students in predominantly white colleges was already too tenuous, our identities too scrambled, to admit to ourselves that our black pride remained incomplete. And to admit our doubt and confusion to whites, to open up our psyches to general examination by those who had caused so much of the damage in the first place, seemed ludicrous, itself an expression of self-hatred. For there seemed no reason to expect that whites would look at our private struggles as a mirror into their own souls, rather than yet more evidence of black pathology. It was in observing that division, I think, between what we talked about privately and what we addressed publicly, that I'd learned not to put too much stock in those who trumpeted black self-esteem as a cure for all our ills, whether substance abuse or teen pregnancy or black-on-black crime. By the time I reached Chicago, the phrase self-esteem seemed to be on everyone's lips, activists, talk show hosts, educators, and sociologists. It was a handy catch-all to describe our hurt, a sanitized way of talking about the things we'd been keeping to ourselves. But whenever I tried to pin down this idea of self-esteem, the specific qualities we hoped to inculcate, the specific means by which we might feel good about ourselves, the conversation always seemed to follow a path of infinite regress. Did you dislike yourself because of your color, or because you couldn't read and couldn't get a job? Or perhaps it was because you were unloved as a child? Only, were you unloved because you were too dark, or too light, or because your mother shot heroin into her veins? And why did she do that anyway? Was the sense of emptiness you felt a consequence of your kinky hair, or the fact that your apartment had no heat and no decent furniture? Or was it because deep down you imagined a godless universe? Maybe one could not avoid such questions on the road to personal salvation. What I doubted was that all the talk about self-esteem could serve as the centerpiece for an effective black politics. It demanded too much honest self-reckoning from people. Without such honesty, it easily degenerated into vague exhortation. Perhaps with more self-esteem, fewer blacks would be poor, I thought to myself, but I had no doubt that poverty did nothing for our self-esteem. Better to concentrate on the things we might all agree on. Give that black man some tangible skills and a job. Teach that black child reading and arithmetic in a safe, well-funded school. With the basics taken care of, each of us could search for our own sense of self-worth. Ruby shook up this predisposition of mine. The wall I had erected between psychology and politics, the state of our pocketbooks, and the state of our souls. In fact, that particular episode was only the most dramatic example of what I was hearing and seeing every day. It expressed itself when a black leader casually explained to me that he never dealt with black contractors. A black man will just mess it up, and I'll end up paying white folks to do it all over again. Or in another leader's rationale for why she couldn't mobilize other people in her church. Black folks are just lazy, Barack. Don't want to do nothing. Often the word nigger replaced black in such remarks. A word I had once liked to think was spoken in jest, with a knowing irony, the inside joke that marked our resilience as a people. Until the first time I heard a young mother use it on her child to tell him he wasn't worth shit, or watching teenage boys use it to draw blood in a quick round of verbal sparring. The transformation of the word's original meaning was never complete. Like the other defenses we erected against possible hurt, this one, too, involves striking out at ourselves first. If the language, the humor, the stories of ordinary people were the stuff out of which families, communities, economics would have to be built, then I couldn't separate that strength from the hurt and distortion that lingered inside us. And it was the implication of that fact, I realized, that had most disturbed me when I'd looked into Ruby's eyes. The stories that I'd been hearing from the leadership, all the records of courage and sacrifice and overcoming of great odds, hadn't simply arisen from struggles with pestilence or drought or even mere poverty. They had arisen out of a very particular experience with hate. That hate hadn't gone away. It formed a counter-narrative, buried deep within each person, and at the center of which stood white people, some cruel, some ignorant, sometimes a single face, sometimes just a faceless image of a system claiming power over our lives. I had to ask myself whether the bonds of community could be restored without collectively exorcising that ghostly figure that haunted black dreams. Could Ruby love herself
they appeared as Marty.
Without hating blue eyes?
Context of white supremacy. The number to dial is 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you have a question or would like to participate. Use number one more time, 760-569-7676. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you have questions. The bluest eye. Once again, I am reminded of why I say I think black people should read this book. Not that you need to go out and vote for President Obama, or should have voted for him when you had the chance, or that you need to get a t-shirt and be his biggest cheerleader, but just I would be very interested to see how a black child, black teenager, how they would respond to hearing the President of the United States, the passage that you just heard, hearing that from the President. Now, what do you think? I would love to hear that from some 14, 13, 10, 8-year-old black people, black children. See how that impacted their brain computer. Woo! We'll see from the folks on the line. Anyone has any thoughts? Prabhupada should be with us.
Hopefully people won't wait till the last minute. If you would like to participate, if you have comments, notes, questions, things you would like to share, Star 6, Be More in Prize, your lines should be open.
Gus had a question for you. I know he's mentioned the character Marty. I'm kind of foggy on who Marty is.
He's supposed to be this white guy. They said Jewish, but he said white first, so I'm sticking with that. White person, white male, who I guess was serving as a mentor in Chicago, helping him with regards to organizing, going around to these different areas, working with these black people, trying to get them jobs back in this factory or plant, whatever it is, where the black and non-white people were losing their jobs. That's Marty.
Okay. Yeah, I want to mention some things that were omitted. I think, so I'm looking at the Kindle version, which is page 162. After he meets with the Reverend and Marty arrived and he says, feels like shit. So I'm thinking, like, you know, there goes the excrement reference again when, you know, talking about Reverend Smalls. So I thought that was interesting. And he says, I told him about Reverend Smalls and he started to laugh. Guess it's a good thing I didn't tag along, huh? You know, he's sort of making light of that experience. He says, I wasn't amused. Why didn't you warn me about Smalls? He said, I did warn you, Marty said. But there was, let's see. He basically says, he's just a politician who happens to wear a collar. Anyway, it's not the end of the world. You should just be glad you learned your lesson early. So they omitted this part. Yes, but which lesson? So it's kind of like, is it the lesson that, hey, Marty's going to sort of not reveal certain information or maybe set me up for an ambush? Or was it about Reverend Smalls? But they omitted that for some reason.
That is an important omission. I had forgot all about the get the omissions out early so people can think about that as well. There were some big omissions here that it took me a while to kind of catch back up because they were throwing stuff out about the organizing. One of the omissions, and then I'll mute my line so if other folks want to participate. And again, my bad, I have the PDF, so my pages are not going to correspond, but I think this is, I'll give context. This should be by chapter 8 forward, where, okay, it says, I suppose it was then that I understood the difficulty of what Marty had tried to pull off and the depth of his miscalculation. It wasn't so much that Angela had missed some of the details of Marty's presentation. As we continued to talk, it had become apparent that she had understood Marty's proposal at least as well as I did. No, the real meaning of her remark was this. She had come to doubt the relevance to her own situation of keeping the LTV plant open. Organizing with the unions might help the few blacks who remained in the plants keep their jobs. It wouldn't dent the rolls of the chronically unemployed anytime soon. A job bank might help workers who already had skills and experience find something else. It wouldn't teach the black teenage dropout how to read or compute. In other words, it was different for black folks. It was different now, just as it had been different for Angela's grandparents, who'd been barred from the unions, then spat on as scabs, for her parents, who had been kept out of the best patronage jobs that the machine had to offer in the days before patronage became a dirty word. In his eagerness to do battle with the downtown power brokers, the investment bankers, in their fancy suits, Marty wanted to wish such differences away as part of an unfortunate past. But for someone like Angela, the past was the present. It determined her world with a force of infinitely more real than any notions of class solidarity. It explained why more blacks hadn't been able to move out into the suburbs while the going was still good, why more blacks hadn't climbed up the ladder into the American dream. It explained why the unemployment in the black neighborhoods was more widespread and longstanding, more desperate, and why Angela had no patience with those who wanted to treat black people and white people exactly the same. Very important point that was omitted, and in fact, they tossed that whole section out, I believe, this meeting where Angela and some of the other black people were not pleased with Marty's plan. They had they made a job bank program, and a local college was supposed to run it, and of course, it was not providing any jobs. Black people were showing up to job interviews where there was no job, weren't getting any training. Total failure, and the black people were upset about this. Very important segment that was omitted. I'll mute my line if any of the folks have things you all would like to share.
I, too, thought about the bluest eye during this segment, the whole Ruby with the blue contacts thing, and how he talked about how, well, he didn't say non-whites, but non-whites were vulnerable to the images and standards of beauty that we're bombarded with every day. So I took note on that. And I also couldn't help but note and also mention again this reoccurring basically description of black females. Because when this segment first came on, he talked about how the three females are standing out there and one of them was dark and heavyset. I think this is probably the third or fourth time probably that he's even described a black female, and it's been that she was dark and plump or dark and heavy set, so I noted that as well. And also when he was talking about him and Marty were praying to our own masters, it reminded me of an image that I saw on Facebook where they had an image of white Jesus at the top of the photo, and then at the bottom of the photo was a black quote-unquote congregation, and it had the word slaves written on there. So I took note of those two things.
That's a good point. I think that is about...
I'm going to say I think that is about the third time that I've heard a black female... reference in the book being heavy set, dark and heavy set. I think that is about the third one. What did you all, what did you make of this incident with Ruby and the blue contacts?
I mean, I kind of... I won't say liked, but I guess I would say appreciated his response. I mean, because he made her, in a sense, not that I liked or appreciated that he made her feel ashamed, but I appreciated that he didn't praise her for having these blue contacts in. So, I don't know. His response was really... I don't know, I appreciated his response. The fact that he didn't praise her for having these blue contacts. He just basically told her, you know, your eyes before were fine. And then she kind of looked down or whatever and felt kind of ashamed. So I appreciated that he didn't praise her for wanting to have these blue eyes.
It seemed like at that moment, Barack was less confused than the woman was about the contacts and what those symbolized. And then when he asked her about it, she just said, oh, they're just contacts, just something different. I mean, I'm sure if you ask Nicki Minaj why she wears a blonde wig, she'd just tell you, oh, it's just a style. But since you have to really go and analyze, you know, why we do certain things, why we're drawn to certain non-constructive things.
Yeah, and it's like everyone is blonde now. I mean, even as far as black males in the entertainment industry or whatever you want to call it, are gone blonde too. It's just like really, like, I mean, well, to be expected. Victim.
Yeah, we do things just thinking that it's a style, and we have no idea what sort of messages it sends about what we're holding up as a standard of beauty.
I will tell you one thing that popped in my mind. That's just a fascinating segment. I mean, it's a lot to ponder on his thoughts afterwards. And I think to B. Moore's point, I think, at least in the writing, it seems that President Obama had some second thoughts about, maybe I shouldn't have said that. I didn't mean to make her feel bad about that, and she is a victim of racism. I appreciated the reflection on how he responded to her. And I appreciated the whole include. I'm glad that was left in the audiobook, but that's why I would love to know who did the editing for the audiobook. Who made the choice about what was going in and what stuff we're gonna cut that out? Because I have seen where they have taken out some segments that are revealing truth about white people. That the passage last week where he says sitting around and trying to think about whether there are quote unquote good white people and bad white people really doesn't mean anything. If white people are dominating, who cares if you got a quote unquote good white person? When that gets left out, but they're okay leaving in things that talk about the difficulties and struggles and things that would be embarrassing, just some of the pitiful conditions of black people, it's okay to leave that in, but we're going to do things to take out why black people are in such a pitiful condition and putting the blame, the fault, on white people. Just some of the things that they took out where he's speaking more honestly about white people and then leaving in this segment and even some of the other segments and just describing the pitiful shape that black people, victims of racism, are in.
I agree, and we've all said it, that there's evidence that President Obama is less confused, but I feel like in this segment it really showed too, because even when he was talking about the conditions that they're in, he didn't just say, oh, they're in this condition because they brought it upon themselves. He's basically saying that they're like this because of racism, white supremacy. So, I mean, just going back to what we all know, I feel like he is less confused.
I like the line where he says, he was talking about predominantly white colleges, and he said that our identities are too scrambled to admit to ourselves that our black pride remain incomplete, and to admit our doubt and confusion to whites, to open up our psyches to general examination by those who had caused so much of the damage in the first place seemed ludicrous. It's an expression of self-hatred, for there seemed to be no reason to expect that whites would look at our private struggles as a mirror into their own souls, rather than yet more evidence of black pathology. And I think about, like, what Neely Fuller said, like, you know, first thing you got to realize is that you're a victim. And I think sometimes it's difficult for us to take, you know, to accept that, okay, I'm a victim of white supremacy. But I think that's a necessary first step in order to move on from there.
Shadow should be with us as well.
Yes, thanks, Steph. Yeah, that was with the part with Ruby and the blue eyes. Is that what you guys were discussing just now?
Yes, sir.
I had bookmarked that because I also had the Kindle version, and I thought that was interesting, and I don't know if they left a section out because I was going in and out where he talks about the word nigger and how black people use it amongst themselves. Is that in the audio?
Say it one more time.
He talks about how black people use the word nigger. In the book, like not long before he talks about the blue eyes, and I found both of those to be very interesting. He says in one line with the blue eyes, could Ruby love herself without hating blue eyes? And I thought that was a very thoughtful question that he asked, the kind of question that maybe someone less confused would ask.
I think that was in. I think the part
was in.
Where he talks about the use of the word nigger, I think that was in as well.
That was in.
Am I making that up?
No, I think it was in there.
Okay.
If you're looking at the Kindle Shadow, I think it's page 194. He says, often the word nigger replaced black in such remarks.
Yep.
A word I'd once liked to think was spoken in jest with a knowing irony, the inside joke that marked our resilience as a people. Until the first time I heard a young mother use it on her child to tell him he wasn't worth shit, or watch teenage boys use it to draw blood in a quick round of verbal sparring.
Mm-hmm. That was actually a section I highlighted, yes.
I don't think they edited any of this.
Okay.
I don't think they took out a comma, a exclamation mark, nothing. The passage that, that's what I mean. It's no way I can look at President Obama, even if I hadn't read this, I would think he's got to know what's up. I mean, it's no way you could be president and not know what's up. But with this, it's just like, yeah, this is not a confused person. When I think about confused victims, President Obama is not on that list. I don't know what page this is on, but it's in the whole Ruby and the Blue context section.
Mm-hmm.
It's 1, 2, 3. So it's the second to last paragraph from what we just heard, where he says, maybe one couldn't avoid such questions on the road to personal salvation. What I doubted was that all the talk about self-esteem could serve as the centerpiece of an effective black politics. It demanded too much honest self-reckoning from people. Without such honesty, it easily degenerated into vague exhortation. Perhaps with more self-esteem, fewer blacks would be poor, I thought to myself, but I had no doubt that poverty did nothing for our self-esteem. Just that section right there about the importance of being honest, not lying to yourself, and that just doing a whole lot of I'm black and I'm proud is not really going to solve our problems. I mean, woof. I don't know. What did you all think about that?
Yes, and he has said that in different ways more than once in the book. I can't remember exactly the other time
he said it. The skin bleaching.
Yes, that's right. Yep. He did say that with the skin bleach, which is another area that I stood out to me, yes. So, yeah, you had said that by reading this, but I read this during the time period that you were off the air. And just as you said, it showed me that, yeah, he's a lot less confused. And as you said, I'd say 95% of the victims that I meet. And I also think that the book illustrated how difficult it was to go into the, quote, black community and just start to you know, organize or get things going. He showed what a struggle it could be.
And Marty seemed to just sort of mock him for it, or just, you know, like have fun at his expense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Without really giving him true solutions or really trying to help him. So Marty, so it seems like a sort of a slick character.
Racist seemed like some of the black people he was working with. They were trying to tell him, we think this guy's racist.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I think that's at least the second time. Actually, that's the third time. That is the third time I can think of in this book where President Obama has been defending a white person against allegations of racism. It happened with his grandmother, the incident where he was defending her when his grandfather thought she was being racist. And then when Marcus, when he was complaining about their treatment in high school in Hawaii, it's at least the third time where he has been defending white people against an accusation of racism.
I've always wondered how difficult it must be understanding racism, even to the extent he did, and having a white parent. You know, having white grandparents that raised you, I feel like that would be very difficult and confusing.
Yeah, you sense his moments of irritation sometimes, and I think, you know, most recently when he talks about watching that film, Black Orpheus. So, like, he knows that, you know, she's liking this movie for all the wrong reasons, and it's sort of irking him.
Was that the movie where he was, oh, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Was that the movie where she was watching the natives and getting all misty-eyed, and he was kind of disappointed in her?
Yeah, dancing and singing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems
like... Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. No, I was going to say, it's like, you know, he defends them, but then there's those moments where they say certain things, and I guess you have to really look at the power of words, where they will say certain things to him, these so-called white friends, and he gets furious, you know? He gets very angry. So he's paying attention. So it's not like, you know, they're saying things and they're just going way over his head. He realizes, wow, that could be a racist comment right there. You know, I don't like it. He doesn't necessarily confront them there, but you could tell it's something that he went home and he thought about. And I know in my personal experience, I mean, when I was more confused, white people would say things to me that I felt like were sort of insulting, but very slickly insulting. I didn't have a verbal response at that moment, but it is something that when I went home, I thought about it, and it just, you know, it really made me kind of emotionally angry. Even though at the time I did not know how to verbally respond to it. By asking a question.
What did you all think about the segment? This, I'll read it. It was expressed when a black leader casually explained to me that he never dealt with black contractors. A black man will just mess it up, and I'll end up paying white folks to do it all over again. Or in another leader's rationale for why she couldn't mobilize other people in her church. Black folks are just lazy. Barack, they don't want to do nothing. Oh, and that goes right into the whole nigger thing. Like, I thought that, I think we're going to be hearing a lot of that coming up. If the reports that white people have been making about the rise in anti-blackness, and they use the term anti-blackness, I think you'll be getting more of that. And ironically, you'll probably be hearing that about President Obama. We'll never vote for another black person. Look what he did. You put him in the White House, and everything is just in tatters and ruins, just like black people.
I think a lot of times it's a lot less threatening for non-white people to attack each other than attack the system. Because when we attack each other, there is no consequence for that. I think Neely Fuller calls it shadow fighting.
I think this passage, I highlighted this one too, and I think this connects to that other one and the whole blue eyes. So I just think that is fascinating. I think that's at least the third or fourth segment. I was just like, wow, I would just put that, make that an audio segment, just have that on repeat, put his picture, president of the White House, bing, this is what he said. I'm just trying to give context. My page numbers are going to be worthless for y'all, so I don't even want to give them out. This is back there just talking about the elections in Chicago around Harold Washington. He says, and it was this dual sense of individual advancement and collective decline that I thought accounted for some of the attitudes agitating Will when we'd spoken the night of the rally. I'd heard it in the excessive pride some of the men took in the well-stocked bars they built in their basements with the lava lamps and mirrored walls, in the protective plastic that the women kept over their spotless carpets and sofas. In all of it, one saw a determined effort to shore up the belief that things had, in fact, changed, if only some people would start acting right. I try to avoid driving through Roseland when I can. A woman from neighboring Washington Heights explained to me one evening, people down there are just rougher. You can see it in the way they keep up their homes. You didn't see things like that when white folks still lived there. Distinctions between neighborhoods, then blocks, then finally neighbors within a block, attempts to cordon off, control the decay. Again, I'm the bluest eyes. I'm reminded of, I don't remember her name, but she was a lighter complexion black female. I think she called Ficola a black bitch when she killed, the cat got killed, her son killed the cat and blamed it on Ficola. And the mom came in. It reminds me of that mindset when Toni Morrison was explaining to black people who they saw a difference between black people and niggers. Same sentiment.
Was that before or after? I remember reading that, but I couldn't find it.
It's well before the blue context,
okay.
Sorry. It's if you can find the part where they're talking about how some of the black people were doing okay, but they were nervous about if their children would be okay. Some of the children were still living at home, or they were doing well, but they had just left everybody else. It's right after that. Let's see.
Okay.
If I can give out at least a chapter. Chapter 8.
I think the character's name from Blue Side was Geraldine.
Good memory. Yeah, that's I appreciate that honesty. I'm glad they left that in the audiobook, some of the things victims of racism do to try to insulate themselves from the pain, trauma that we experience, whether it's blue contacts or a bar or some new Jordans or vehicles or getting a nice house, all these different things to try to insulate us and pretend that things are not as bad as they are, that we are not, in fact, still on the plantation.
And the pathology of that is it's like the 30 for 30 documentary you discussed, Broke. That's what we're going to end up being, broke, because we're trying to buy things to compensate for our lack of justice. It never works.
It's funny when you said that, I was reminded of a line in a Kanye West song.
You remember the line?
He said, we're trying to buy our 40 acres in a mule bag. Have to. It's off for All Falls Down. Look it up. I got my computer in front of me. Where he basically talked about it, about us buying things to. To stop the pain of racism.
Yeah, he has a line in that song. I'm pulling it up. He said, "We buy our way out of jail, but we can't buy freedom. We'll buy a lot of clothes when we don't really need them. Things we buy to cover up what's inside, because they make us hate ourselves and love their wealth. That's why shorties hollering where the ball is at. Drug dealers buy Jordans, crackheads buy crack, and a white man get paid off of all of that."
Yep. "For the road to riches and diamond rings, we shine because they hate us, floss because they degrade us. We try to buy back our 40 acres, and for that paper, look how low we'll stoop. Even if you're in a Benz, you still a nigger in a coupe." Yeah, just reminded me of that when you said that.
Or a nigger in the White House. They've been saying that a lot. President Obama pretty much said that.
Another Chicago boy.
Bruce Byrne, she...
the plantation.
Oh, go ahead. You're good.
I just said that we can't buy our way out of the plantation. It's not possible.
Bruce Byrne, she emailed. She said that apparently white people released a video by, I guess, President Obama and his campaign team where he was tearing up, maybe. As he was thanking people that volunteered to work for his campaign, and he was talking about when he was a community organizer and saying that he wasn't very organized. He was still trying to figure it out, learn what to do. Apparently that's something that just happened in the past couple of days.
Yeah, I was thinking that, you know, you could, maybe there were a lot, they didn't show the audience, but if there were a lot of young white people, I mean, it's obvious why he wasn't as effective as they are.
Going back to the whole quote-unquote difference between niggers versus blacks, I think this is like the, well, it's come up several times in the book where he talks about basically how some blacks think that they're better. I remember he was talking about, I think this was when he was in Los Angeles in college, and he was talking about how some blacks had impeccable English and they wore designer suits and something about them being upset. Not, do you remember that passage I'm trying to think of?
Oh yeah, I highlighted it. That was one of the ones that they omitted. Yeah, I can pull that one up, I think, without too much trouble.
Okay, so yeah, I thought about that, and it made me think of W.E.B. Du Bois and The Talented Tenth. Now, initially, I was like, okay, why am I thinking about that? But then I thought about it applied to me because I'm a first-generation college student. And it was when I was becoming less confused. When I got into college, I, in a sense, felt better, not necessarily than my family members, but in a sense, yes. I felt kind of better than my family members because here I am, first-generation college student. So, okay, I'm not like them that's back home. They never got away from, you know, where we're from. I'm doing better because I'm in college and I'm doing this and I'm educated and things like this. So this whole talk of niggers versus blacks made me think of how I, in a sense, thought that there was a difference until I became less confused and got the code book and things like that. And I'm like, okay, doesn't matter how much education I have, how much money I'm wanting to make or anything like that. We're non-white. We're all non-white. We're all victims. And so, yeah, I mean, I thought about that when I was just thinking about the whole niggers versus blacks thing. I mean, I even made a video, I believe, on YouTube, the whole niggers versus black phenomenon or whatever you want to call it. So, yeah, I thought about The Talented Tenth for some reason because I really, like, was in that mindset when I initially got into college.
That the passage that B. Moore is referencing, again, my bad, the pages. I'll see if I can just get the book. That way I can give out the page numbers. He says, we, the half-breeds and the college degreed, take a survey of the situation and think to ourselves, why should we get lumped in with the losers if we don't have to? We become only so grateful to lose ourselves in the crowd, America's happy, faceless marketplace. And we're never so outraged as when a cabbie drives past us or the woman in the elevator clutches her purse. Not so much because we're bothered by the fact that such indignities are what less fortunate coloreds have to put up with every single day of their lives, although that's what we tell ourselves, but because we are wearing a Brooks Brothers suit and speak impeccable English and yet have somehow been mistaken for an ordinary nigger. Omitted
yes,
from the audiobook.
So thank you so much for reading that, Gus.
Uh, 8225, you should be with us as well.
Greetings, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I was listening the other day to clip of, actually, I think it was reading a clip on the code.net, Mr. Fuller, and he went into the meaning of nigger, and he said it came from niggling. I looked it up. I heard nigger, but I hadn't heard of niggling. And in the etymological dictionary, it says, from Norwegian dialect, nigla, be busy with trifles. And it's kind of fitting, you know, marginalized with trifles. So I just think it, until we figure a way to not be marginalized, whether it's, you know, within the U.S. or globally, the name kind of fits, or it's a job description.
Yeah, I think President Obama understands that very clearly. We only have about 10 minutes left. Make sure we do not have a repeat of last week. If you think you want to share something, before things wrap up, get your hand up. If you have something you want to share, or any of the folks that are already on, I think we got about 13 minutes. Yeah, we should not have people waiting until we get to 7 p.m. Or 6 p.m., depending on where you are. Say, oh, I want to share. I have something I want to say. Go ahead and get your hand up. Be nervous. We're all victims here. Yeah, feel free to share. Bruce Vaughn, she wrote in, she said that that passage President Obama had, she said that her father does not go to black doctors. He does not hire black lawyers. When a black person does something that he is impressed by, he says in a shocked voice, and she has this in quotes, unfortunately, a nigga did that? I suspect her father is not the only one who does that sort of thing. I suspect a high percentage of black, non-white people worldwide have the exact same programming, brain trashing.
But isn't that interesting that, you know, we always say we have to work twice as hard. So how does that reconcile with we ain't no good, you know? It's a disconnect, but that's, you know, more confusion.
It's been my, I'm seeing just since we've been doing this, I've been talking about just, we're reading it every week now, so I've been asking black people that talk about racism, like, oh, did you read President Obama's book? And most black people that I talk to, the answer is no. And I just, wow, I think there are quite a few passages that could be used that would have some weight. Yeah, I would recommend folks read the book, particularly even some of the black people who complain about President Obama, saying that they don't like him and he's not doing anything for him. Not that I think this will make you, you know, fall in love with him and think he's the greatest thing ever, but just I think it might give you a better perspective, both on the system of white supremacy and he as a victim of racism. Yeah, it's at least, I can't even recommend the audio book. I'm so, I would say tough up and read the book. I mean, you can put the audio book for people that they really don't want to read, but you're going to miss a lot
you're going to miss a lot of information if you do the audiobook.
Yes, I had read The Audacity of Hope. I hadn't read this book when you mentioned it. And that The Audacity of Hope doesn't focus on race nearly as much. And it seemed to me like a lot of white people had read this book.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
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 What does that mean? What do y'all think about that? The fact that this book is out, we are not quite halfway through, maybe about 40% of the way through the book. What does that say to you all? The fact that, that's been my observation too. It seems white people are very familiar with this book. They read it, took notes, the whole nine. Black people, whatever their opinion, they don't seem very knowledgeable. What do you think about that?
Do they think that they can trust him already just because, you know, because they think he knows what's up?
I think ever since, especially that speech he made at the Democratic National Convention that brought him out, he became a very interesting person. And I think a lot of white people just did research on him. They wanted to know who he was, what he was. I keep hearing these people say that he's the least transparent president ever, but as you have said, he wrote a 500-page book about his life. What do you want to know? I think, I don't know if you'll ever do it, but for my own reading, I know I'm going to read Dinesh D'Souza's Obama's America when I get a chance, just to see what he says about him and why he says it. Because he references this book in that book I've heard. Yes, he is.
I haven't read that book. Did anybody else have any thoughts on that? Any of the folks on the line on white people being very familiar with this book? Non-white people not so familiar?
Anybody?
No pressure.
I had read the book. I had actually read both books. I think I borrowed one from my grandmother and another from my dad, white person who had bought it. and I read both of them. The second one is a policy book, but, you know, harkens back to the first book. But it's definitely different listening, or I guess if I were to read the first book again, you know, becoming less confused, it all kind of pops out. So, but it's still there on first read, I think.
Yeah, but I do wonder why that is. That it does seem like so many more, like you said, white people seem very familiar with the book. He's even made references to it and jokes to it that I didn't get at the time. You know, he said something about eating dog or something in some joke he made at some place, and I didn't know what he was talking about.
I think, you know, like mentioning the 2004 speech, and that was, you know, a step out on the national stage, and, you know, all the pundits or whoever, all are going to, you know, check out the new thing, and it's sort of a parallel to music, where I'll find, you know, white people more knowledgeable about old black music than black people. You know, they have the resources to do the research, and necessity to know about the next new thing, hipster, just that term.
It's funny you say that because I had a discussion with a friend of mine about I was arguing with some people about hip hop, and the hip hop that I considered to be, you know, good hip hop or whatever, lots of times a lot of non-white black males would be like, nah, nah, and I found myself agreeing with white guys more than some of the black guys. I had a black guy tell me Master P was a great rapper, and we ended the conversation there. I saw that we were on two different thought processes, so I stopped the argument.
Oh, I had actually, well, it might be connected. This morning, I was reminded of there was some executive at Microsoft that on his 40th birthday, he had two shorts paid him to come out, and he knew all the lyrics. And his wife was sitting there in the audience hearing him say, bitch, ho, you know, left and right. And then there's a story out here in Seattle about some prosecutor who had been raping the massage parlor Asian chick. And his wife was covering up for him at once he got caught. And so it paralleled to that the wife of the Microsoft executive in the audience, like, yeah, yeah, bitch, hoe, go ahead, you know. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of those lyrics espouse white values, honestly.
Yeah, I think they spend a lot of time studying us, and it's very few of us that study them. I'm just going to relate a personal story. I'll try to make it very quick. I went to see The Invisible Man, the play, in Chicago, and I think it was the first time that they had a play, because everything that gets approved about The Invisible Man, it has to go through a guy named John Callahan, who was a white male. So he owns all the rights, releases to Ralph Ellison's works. Oh. So, I sat up in the front row, and I happened to hear a female, older woman talking, and she was bragging about being John Callahan's sister. So it's kind of like she's here standing on top like of a pyramid of skeletons, and she's saying like, hey, you know, we own this. And so I talked to her more, and I found out that John Callahan had befriended Ellison when he was older, maybe in the 70s. I think he was a grad student. And just start hanging around him and, you know, having talks and maybe eating lunch together. And then it turns out, Ralph Ellison ends up signing away all the rights to him. So anything that's made with any of Ralph Ellison's work, it has to go through a white man. And he edited the book 3 days before the shooting. So we don't know what's been taken out of that book. I mean, and that was never published while Ralph Ellison was alive. But Ralph Ellison, I mean, as knowledgeable as he was, he signed over all of his rights to a white male who's getting royalty checks every time anything is produced or any time a book is sold. And it's very unfortunate.
Mm.
So they make sure they're always on their job in every area. I mean, that's a feather in the cap to say, oh, I'm getting royalty checks. I'm a white man. I'm getting royalty checks from Ralph Ellison's work. So every time you buy a book, I'm getting paid.
Hmm. You can't even really be surprised about that 2012. I mean, that's been the case forever. I was going to pick some of the numerous examples of this happening, but we can just hit the Cow's Archives. Racist suspect MC Search owns the rights to Nas Illmatic. We discussed that in the archives. So, you know, that's standard operating procedure. White people know how to do that. By age 13, they got that. Okay. Bump to a black person, they got a book, album, anything that looks like it might be profitable.
already got that down. Boom, boom, boom. By the time that 10 years later, you'll own everything. Anybody mentions that black person's name, you'll get some money. They standard operating. In fact, I was watching videos today. Another former Cal's guest, Bill Ayers, Illinois, University of Illinois, distinguished professor. And he was saying he wrote Dreams from My Father. He was in front of a whole group of people, and he said, I wrote that book. We can find proof. I'll get the royalties for it. So, you know, white people know what the deal is. And Bill Ayers, terrorist, was on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. Terrorist, now distinguished professor. I was going to get in just about white people's knowledge of this book. I think it goes again. If anyone is ignorant about racism, it's black people. White people, they are very thorough about study, particularly if you're thinking this nigga is going to get to the White House and we're not going to read everything that you ever wrote from kindergarten. White people are very thorough. And just with my understanding now, so if I'm a white person, right, I already got my PhD in white supremacy racism. When I read this book, that's going to stand out to me. Oh, okay. This black person, he's got a white parent, and I keep seeing where he is defending these white people who are being accused of racism, and he's saying, no, they're not. No, they're not. That's not what it is. No, they're not. That's going to stand out to a white or racist. Some of the other things in the book, even when he reveals he understands racism, white supremacy, but then if he prevents something later in the book that contradicts that understanding, that's going to stand out. If I'm a white person, when I hear him talk about the book, these interviews, the one with Connie Martinson that I've been playing, he did a lot of them. Next week I'll play the one he did with Charlie Rose. It's from 2004. So this is it's like 9 years after the book was published, but it's still before he was senator. The interview with Charlie Rose where they're talking about this. When they hear him talk, and he is talking as though black people, they have a problem with white people, they have a problem with black people, we just don't understand it. When they hear that, they say, oh, okay, okay, we might be able to use this nigger. I think that's the sort of thing that's going on in the brain computer of a racist when they read this text. I could be wrong, but keep that in mind as we continue to read it. We still got a ways to go. We haven't even got to, I thought we were going to get to his bedroom experiences today, but maybe that'll pop up next week. We have done I-3. Does anybody have any final sentence they want to get in before we wrap up?
I just think you're absolutely right, and that's in the mentality of all those people, white folks are in the audience, you know, clapping for Obama. Just, yay, he gives us cover, you know. That's all that is.
Yeah, I think white, I'm sure they pay special attention. That line, the white revisionism, they were talking about Gramps and his lie about them being in the spirit of John Brown and fighting against racism, and that's why we left Kansas. No good racist white people wouldn't let my daughter, made up that whole story, and him co-signing on and saying, yeah, that's what he wanted to be. That's the best. That's what he really believed in, and even though it didn't happen, that's really what he believed deep down in his heart. White people, I'm sure, that sticks out to the, he's willing to co-sign on our lies. We can use that boy. I could be wrong, but I would just say keep that in mind. We got about 60% of the book left, so I'm sure there will be other times where this will pop up. We can ponder on it, see if it makes sense. Looking forward. I'll make sure to remind folks the book study session starts at 7. I think some people were confused. They're accustomed to the 8 o'clock start time. The book session is 7. It's just easier for me. I didn't think it would be that much of a difficulty for listeners just doing an hour early, so I'll make sure that's known, but it'll be recorded. Archives will be available
through about an hour, should be available on iTunes and online, Stitcher as well, stitcher.com. We will be back tomorrow. Compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Central. Looking forward to hearing what you all have experienced post-election. I'm very eager to hear what white people have been saying on the job, or if you've just been out and about and hearing things. I hope people have been paying attention to the news, reading the paper, really paying attention to what's happening locally, nationally, globally. I spoke to Dr. Welsing today, and she said that she had like 100-some people at the Welsing Institute yesterday evening, and they were coming in. They were bringing her information about things happening to President Obama, what happened down at Ole Miss, where they rioted Tuesday night after the election, in Hampton, Sydney, in Virginia. They didn't use the term riot. I think they used the term post-election unrest. That was how they phrased it, at Hampton, Sydney, which is an all-males college in Virginia. But, yeah, just I'm looking forward. I hope people will be able to dial in tomorrow, share. I'll mute my line and we can just process everything that's happened past, I guess, 4 or 5 days. Thank you, everyone, for tuning into the program. I hope it has been a constructive investment of your evening. Invest if you think the program is constructive. The blog, my PayPal account, is at the top of my blog, racism-notes.blogspot.com, racism-notes.blogspot.com, listener-supported. Thanks to everyone who has invested. You can invest in justice as well. Just do justice today.blogspot.com. There has been the trifling antics of white people has been boundless since the election. Cynical African, he had a post where they had some sort of trifling Obama doll. He posted it. It's on. He put it on my Facebook page. I think it's on his website as well, cynicalafrican.com, where white people have just been letting it fly. The refinement is going out the window. I listened to the Opie and Anthony show this week. They're letting it fly. No more refinement. We're letting you know what the deal is. We're upset, and you niggas are about to get it. That's pretty much what I've heard all week long. We'll chat it up tomorrow. Let's see. I guess I'll do a for real prayer tomorrow. Just doing the quick one for today, but we will make sure we get that in tomorrow. It has been time. Creator, things are very serious on the plantation. Please assist victims of racism, non-white people worldwide, in being mindful, attentive, and serious. Please aid us in understanding this is no time to be serious, playing around, underestimating white people. We will be back tomorrow evening. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out.